people who are in the back room listening that we have a quorum and I think we should get started. So the October 23rd public meeting of the Air Resources Board will come to order, and we'll start with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, and justice for all.
Clerk, would you please call the roll? Dr. Barnes? Ms. Berg? Ms. Diadema? Supervisor Hill?
Here.
Ms. Kennard?
Here.
Mayor Lovridge? Mrs. Reardon?
Here.
Supervisor Roberts? Professor Sperling?
Here.
Dr. Tallis?
Present.
Chairman Nichols?
Here.
Madam Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you very much. As usual, we have a closed session listed on our agenda as a standing item in which we can receive reports on lawsuits in which we're litigants, but we're not going to be holding the closed session at today's meeting. And I'm also supposed to give you the logistical reminders that the exits are in the back of the room here, and in the event of a fire siren or alarm going off, we're supposed to leave the room immediately, evacuate and go down the stairs and out of the building until we hear an all-clear signal. That has happened a couple of times, so can't take it for granted. Also, just a reminder that if you wish to testify on any of the items before the board, we will be imposing a time limit of 3 minutes, and we would appreciate it if you have written testimony or a longer testimony, you would just summarize it in your oral remarks. It's much easier for us to follow testimony if people don't actually read from their prepared text, because we have it in front of us and we can read faster than you can talk. With that, I think we will begin with the health report.
Thank you, Chairman Nichols. Good morning, board members. Asthma is a major health problem that affects nearly 5 million people in California. It's a complex illness whose causes are poorly understood. Today's health update is the latest in a continuing series of updates on the subject of asthma and the role of air pollution in causing it and exacerbating its symptoms. Today's presentation focuses on a study just published in July 2008, which investigates the impact of early childhood and prenatal exposure to criteria pollutants on the lung function of young children with asthma. The study was co-founded by the Air Resources Board as part of our effort to push the frontiers of understanding on this important health issue. Jeff Austin from our Health and Exposure Assessment Branch will give the presentation. Mr. Austin.
Thank you, Mr. Goldstein. Good morning, Chairman Nichols, members of the board. Asthma is different from other diseases linked with air pollution in that it affects large numbers of children. While heart disease, strokes, and cancer predominantly affect older adults, asthma strikes people of all ages, including infants and children, with debilitating and potentially life-threatening consequences. For today's update, I will present the results of a study that examines the relationship between exposure to air pollution and lung function in young asthmatic children. Asthma is the leading cause of chronic illness in American children, according to the Center for Disease Control's National Health Interview Surveys. In 2005, an estimated 16%, or 1.5 million children in California, had been diagnosed with asthma at some point in their lives. The prevalence is rising. 4 years earlier, it was 14%. A report recently released by researchers at UCLA stated that 28% of the children in California who suffer from daily or weekly asthma symptoms miss at least 1 week of school per year. The cost of treating children with asthma in California is estimated to be around $500 million per year. At present, the causes and risk factors for developing asthma are a subject of active research. Asthma appears to be the result of a very complex interaction of genetic susceptibility and outdoor and indoor environmental factors. The link between air pollution and asthma is well established. Several past health updates have focused on this subject. A growing body of research shows that children who live near traffic are more likely to have asthma and suffer worse symptoms. Numerous studies in California and elsewhere have confirmed this effect. Studies have also clearly demonstrated that children exposed to higher ambient levels of ozone and particulate matter are more likely to be admitted to emergency rooms for acute asthma symptoms. The evidence that air pollution plays a role in causing asthma is not as strong. However, the ARB's Children's Health Study found that 9 to 16-year-olds who were active outdoors and lived in high ozone areas were more likely to develop asthma. Parts of the Central Valley suffer much higher rates of asthma among children than the rest of the state. The rate of illness in Fresno County, for example, is 50% higher than the statewide rate. The Fresno Asthmatic Children's Environment Study, or FACES, was initiated to study how air pollution may contribute to this problem. Mostly funded by the ARB, FACES was designed to examine the effect of long-term exposure to air pollution on the course of childhood asthma. Today's study is the first to report findings from FACES. The main question it sets out to answer is, to what extent does prenatal and early life exposure to air pollution impair lung function in young asthmatic children? The study examined 232 asthmatic children in the Fresno urban area, aged 6 to 11. The study group was drawn from a broad spectrum of California's population. 14% of the children were African American, 38% were Hispanic, and 45% were white non-Hispanic. Almost half of the children were from low or moderate income families whose household income was less than $30,000 per year. 9% of the children's mothers smoked during pregnancy. To estimate exposure, pollutant concentrations were spatially interpolated to each child's home address, then averaged over key developmental periods in the child's life, the three trimesters of gestation, the entire gestation period, the first 3 and first 6 years of life, and lifetime. To assess the severity of their asthma, each child's lung function was measured using spirometry, as shown here. This information was used to construct statistical models to relate lung function to pollution exposure, medical history, socioeconomic status, ethnicity, and other factors. The study used a sophisticated, recently developed statistical methodology to find the factors with the strongest impact on lung function. The investigators found that the children most exposed to carbon monoxide, PM10, and nitrogen dioxide suffered a reduction of up to 8% in lung function compared to the children who were least exposed. What is even more striking is that the timing of the exposure is important. The investigators found a particularly strong association between prenatal exposure and reduced lung function for all three pollutants. For carbon monoxide, the first 6 years of life was also a critical window of exposure. Taken together, these findings suggest that prenatal and early life exposures to these pollutants may lead to reduced lung function in young asthmatic children. The study presented today underscores the importance of reducing air pollution exposure and improving the health of asthmatic children, a substantial proportion of the children in California. It found an association between prenatal exposure and reduced lung function, and additional research is underway that addresses other aspects of the role of air pollution in children's asthma. For example, the ARB is currently funding analyses of two large surveys, the California Health Interview Survey and the Los Angeles Family and Neighborhood Survey, to answer questions about the effect of environment, socioeconomic status, genetic susceptibility, and pollution exposure on asthma response. Results from these studies should become available in the next few years, and we'll continue to expand our knowledge of the disease. This concludes the presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I have a question.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, we're still dealing, if I may just interrupt, for anybody who's watching this on the web, we're not seeing the presentation because we're having technical difficulties. So apparently they can see the room, but they cannot actually see the presentation, which puts those in the audience in the exact same position as the chairman, because my screen isn't working either. It's not the fault of the company that's doing the video. It seems to be a problem here in the building, but we're trying to fix it.
Was this study, did it differentiate socioeconomic group, whether that was a risk factor in itself, maybe even overpowering exposure?
Not specifically, no. They did look at socioeconomic factors and various exposure metrics, but they didn't specifically differentiate.
Coming from Fresno, I'd have to make a personal comment that this is a very real problem we have. One reason why I'm here is because of what happened when I was a soccer coach for under 12 kids. I used to carry probably sometimes no fewer than 5 little inhalers for the kids out there in the fields that would come in and get a little pop and go back out and play soccer. But it's a real problem in the Central Valley, and I'm glad you bring it to our attention.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. Are there other comments on the board? Yes, Supervisor.
Is there any work being done in looking at sort of the immediate environment that that people live in, as in terms of factors? Because we found that the best practices in helping kids stay in school is affected dramatically by that environment, and yet we seem to be looking at a lot of other factors. So I'm wondering if that could play a role, not only continuing, which is pretty certain, but on an initial basis, and it seems like we're kind of avoiding that.
If I might comment, I'm actually a co-investigator of the study. So first of all, I want to thank the staff for a nice presentation of our work. And I also want to thank the board for their patience with regard to the Fresno Asthmatic Environment, Children's Environment Study. I came up with that acronym FACES. So. But anyway, because the study has been sort of long in gestation, and this is one of the first papers that's come out with some tangible results that have, that can be used in developing policy. But in response to the specific question of Supervisor Roberts about whether we're looking at current factors, the FACES is really designed to look at that. This was something we could publish before we were ready to publish the sort of current factor analysis. The results that we hope to publish soon show that of the criteria pollutants that we've looked at, and we've looked at all of them, NO2 seems to be the one that most is associated with symptoms and changes in lung function that are happening now, so current exposures. So we're hoping to have a publication out soon on that. And there's another study funded by the CDC called Fresno Kicks Asthma that I'm the principal investigator of, where we're trying to specifically look at asthma in schools, and we're going to be associating where kids live in relation to their air pollution exposure, the exposure to traffic, and not only whether they have asthma or not, but how severe their asthma is. I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm not sure, but if I could follow up on the question, unless you wanted to pursue that further,
but
you could just explain
further. I'm not being clear, but it seems like I'm thinking more in sort of the immediate living in conditions and environment.
Oh, and not of the kids.
Exposure to things like pesticides in the home.
Yeah,
things
like dust and mold and things like that.
So one of the things we looked at in FACES is exposures in the home to allergen in the dust, dog, cat, house dust mite, etc., and secondhand smoke exposure. We haven't looked at pesticides. We're indirectly going to look at pesticides, but not from the homes. We're taking Department of Pesticide regulation data on pesticide applications in fields and distance from those fields with regard to asthma outcomes. But we don't have any information on pesticides in the home. We do have information on allergen in the dust and secondhand smoke exposure.
Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
Thank you very much for making the presentation, because we have, you know, really a lot of information we can gather in this particular area. One of the things that, and I can't remember if it was here or I might ask for the investigator to respond, I saw a study where they gave children a little camera and allowed the children to video their environment. And it was very interesting what was found by just the little videos that these children would create about some of the other problems that were in their homes. Have you ever thought of doing that with these children, or is that sort of impossible and expensive?
Well, we currently have NIH funding to continue the FACES project that CARB funding started, and we haven't given the kids cameras, but we have given them GPS devices that they carried around in little backpacks. So we know where they were for stretches of time. But so we do know when they were indoors and when they were outdoors, but we don't know exactly what was in their environment because we didn't have a camera.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was very interesting. Of course, the children got very excited because they could record all of their things. And you know, children, they take very good care about what they're doing, and really demonstrated some of the other problems that were in those homes that, you know, don't relate to necessarily traffic outside, but really concentrate right there with real indoor air pollution.
Yeah, there's no question that indoor exposures are very important with regard to asthma, and so our use of the GPS device is to try to separate, you know, time indoors from time outdoors to give us a better way to estimate exposures to the outdoor pollutants.
Other comments? Yes.
Well, I would just comment that I think that the San Joaquin Valley is a perfect laboratory here. You look at those high rates, and it's so alarming. And intuitively, you think that it's got to be air quality, but there are so many unique factors in the San Joaquin Valley. We look at socioeconomics. You know, a lot of people may not have air conditioning, so perhaps their homes have more mold or dust. Obesity and diet, you know, the role that plays. I was talking with Dr. Bonds here also about, you know, genetic factors, and are there certain racial or ethnic groups that are more predisposed. So I think we have to dig, you know, keep moving forward and dig deep, you know, beyond the surface. And I would just also comment to the board that my boss, Congressman Cardoza, and an entire delegation of elected officials and businesses and educators in the Valley are pushing for UC Merced to develop a medical school for a variety of health-related issues that can be closely studied, and this is at the top of the list, asthma and the unique circumstances and perhaps causes that we may be able to research in the Valley.
I think some of our frustration probably is that the level of effort in these studies, while it's important, it seems so small in proportion to the size of the problem. The Air Resources Board, as I'm sure everybody knows, does have a small basic research budget, but it's really small, and it's the only area of general fund money that we get. Everything else that we do here is supported by various kinds of fees that are targeted towards specific activities, which is wonderful in terms of protecting us in hard budgetary times, but it does really point out the fact that the research program is our most vulnerable area, and yet this is really essential, I think, to being able to develop the kinds of programs that we would like to develop. This is a commercial for your work, Dr. Balms, but
I was just going to say that in the world of air pollution health effects research, CARB is considered a major player, and I mean, it has been for a long time, but I think with the Children's Health Study especially, seen as really probably the air pollution health effects study we've learned the most from. You know, people would feel it in the entire research community with regard to health effects of air pollution if CARB was no longer able to fund, you know, research. And I, so.
Well, we've been able
so thank
to.
Thank you.
Well, we've been able to preserve a modest program here, and not suggesting that we're not going to be doing this research in the future. It's just that it really is worthy of expansion, not of. Not of being cut. Do we have anybody from the audience who asked to comment on this item? All right. If not, there's no action required, but thank you very much for the presentation. We appreciate the focus on this. And we will move to the next item on the agenda. If I could find my agenda here. Which is a public meeting to consider appointments to the Research Screening Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. In early October, the Governor signed Assembly Bill 2991, which expands the Research Screening Committee from the current maximum of 9 members to 11 members and specifies that at least 2 members must have demonstrated expertise in the field of climate change. Dr. Susan Fisher of the Research Planning and Climate Change Outreach Section will make the presentation this morning by describing for the board the credentials of our 2 recommended new Research Screening Committee members, one of whom will serve as a climate change expert. Dr. Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Goldstein. Good morning, Chairman Nichols and members of the board. The board's legislatively mandated Research Screening Committee consists of scientists, engineers, and others knowledgeable, technically qualified, and experienced in air pollution problems. All of the Air Resources Board's research projects are subject to oversight from the Research Screening Committee, which reviews proposed and completed research projects, including the annual research plan that is considered by the Board each summer. Expansion of the RSC and inclusion of members with climate change-related expertise will help the Air Resources Board fulfill its mission, which was significantly expanded by the California Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006, also known as AB 32. I will now summarize the qualifications of Dr. Matthew Kahn and Dr. Suzanne Paulson, both of the University of California, Los Angeles, whom staff recommends the board promote from adjunct members to permanent voting members, effective January 1, 2009. Matthew Kahn is a professor at UCLA's Institute of the Environment, with secondary appointments in the Department of Economics and the Department of Public Policy. He is a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. In addition to UCLA, Dr. Kahn has taught at Columbia, Harvard, Stanford, and Tufts University. He serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of Urban Economics, Regional Science and Urban Economics, and the Journal of Regional Science. Dr. Kahn's most recent books, published in 2006 and 2008, are Green Cities, Urban Growth and the Environment, and Heroes and Cowards, The Social Face of War. His research focus is environmental and urban economics. As an RSC member with climate change expertise, Dr. Kahn will help guide ARB with respect to economic and social dimensions of climate change mitigation strategies. This guidance will be useful for implementation of both technological and voluntary emissions reduction strategies. Suzanne Paulson has been a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UCLA since 1994 and also holds an appointment at UCLA's Institute of the Environment. Dr. Paulson's current research focuses on investigations of toxics and airborne particles, VOC oxidation chemistry, radiative properties and measurements of black and organic carbon aerosols, and climate impacts of biodiesel. Dr. Paulson has served as an advisor to several organizations, including the World Health Organization, and received a career award from the National Science Foundation. As a permanent voting member, Dr. Paulson will strengthen the RSC's expertise in the areas of atmospheric chemistry and measurement of aerosols. In conclusion, staff recommends addition of Drs. Paulson and Kahn to the RSC, with voting status effective January 1, 2009. This will allow the RSC to operate with its full contingent of 11 voting members. Expanding the number of members of the committee to include climate experts and requiring the OSC to review and provide advice on research projects related to climate change will help ORB build an effective regulatory program necessary to implement AB 32.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fisher. I am a colleague of both of these individuals and recommended them initially for service on the research screening committee because I noticed when I got here that although the University of California was well represented, UCLA was not represented at all on the research screening committee. So I actually went out and recruited two of the what I thought were really outstanding people there, and fortunately they were both willing to serve. However, although I don't, since I'm no longer receiving any salary from UCLA, I don't think I am legally prohibited from voting, but perhaps just as an excess of caution, I will not vote on this item. So if you'd like to take it up, go ahead.
Second.
All in favor, please say aye.
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 All right. I will be noted as an abstention then. Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody. This is a great step forward. And by the way, the legislation to expand the steering committee was sponsored by the Air Resources Board. It was something that we actually wanted to get done. So that's a nice segue, I think, into our next item.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This year's legislative session, of course, had many significant bills that will have a direct impact on our activities. Some of the bills, of course, were very controversial, like SB 375 and SB 974. This was a busy legislative year, and of course, going into next year, there is new leadership in both the Senate and the Assembly, and we'll be actively engaged, as we are every year, in working on the important legislation that's put forth. Now, Rob Oglesby, our legislative director, will provide an overview of this past session.
Welcome.
There it is. Madam Chairman, members of the board, Executive Officer Goldstein, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here to talk about our end of session wrap up. The change this year is the session may not be truly over. There's a possibility of a continuation of the session in November. However, the work on the bills is completed. And we've had three special hearings by the legislature this week, so it's an active body on our issues, even now after the recess. Today I'll discuss recently enacted bills that create new programs or add new tasks that will come before you for policy decisions and implementation. I will also provide a brief review of other significant air quality and climate change legislation from 2008 and offer a preview of a few key issue areas likely to receive legislative attention next year. As you well know, the need to improve air quality and reduce global warming emissions has never been more important. Even with this year's focus on the state budget, air pollution and global warming were major themes in the legislature. This year, there was an unprecedented increase in the number of bills related to air quality and climate change, about 300 total. This is about a 50% increase in air bills since climate change emerged as an issue in the legislature. As legislative director, I have been privileged to work on all the landmark bills related to global warming, beginning in 2002 with Assemblymember Pavley's AB 1493. That bill broke new ground by mandating the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions from California's passenger vehicles. AB 1493 demonstrated the widespread public and political support for action at the state level to provide leadership on climate change. AB 1493 was followed in 2006 by AB 32. That bill is known nationally and internationally as the legislative vehicle that established the overarching statutory mandate to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in California. Now another landmark bill is passed and was signed into law by the governor just a few weeks ago. That bill is Senator Steinberg's SB 375. SB 375 builds on AB 1493 and AB 32 because it is the nation's first law to control greenhouse gas emissions by curbing sprawl. I would like to take a few minutes to walk you through the major elements of SB 375 before I move on to other legislative highlights from the year. California's population, now 38 million, is projected to grow to 46 million
by 2030. That is the equivalent of adding 8 new San Franciscos to the state. Each year, California on average builds 135,000 new homes. More people means more cars. More cars means more miles driven, and that growth threatens to erode the progress of all other vehicle-related global warming reduction measures ARB is currently developing. In order to reach the greenhouse gas reduction goals set out in AB 32, Californians need to rethink how we design our communities. SB 375 does this by providing emissions reductions targets and aligning transportation, land use, and housing planning activities. The bill also provides incentives for local governments and developers to follow new, conscientiously planned growth patterns. What this will mean is more environmentally friendly communities, less time spent in cars, more alternative transportation options, and attractive neighborhoods. You will play a large role in ensuring the successful implementation of SB 375, so I want to focus on some of the key provisions of the bill. SB 375 directs ARB to develop regional greenhouse gas emission reduction targets for 2020 and 2035. ARB will work with each of California's 18 metropolitan planning organizations, or MPOs, to adopt a sustainable community strategy that encourages mixed-use development and alternative modes of transportation, like transit, biking, and walking, to reduce the amount of vehicle miles traveled. ARB would later determine if each region is on track to meet its targets. The bill creates incentives for builders to design projects that are consistent with the new sustainable community strategies. Those projects would get streamlined environmental reviews under California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. This map shows the MPO areas covered by SB 375. As you can see, the bill covers all of the urban areas of the state. And now let me preview some of the new responsibilities for you and our partners at the local level. No later than January 31st, 2009, that's right, about 2 months from now, ARB must appoint members to a regional targets advisory committee. The committee will include members drawn from local and regional government, as well as home builder, environmental planning, environmental justice, and affordable housing interests. The committee will recommend factors to consider and methodologies to set greenhouse gas emission reduction targets for the regions. The recommendations are due to ARB by September 30, 2009. With this recommendation in hand, SB 375 requires ARB to set targets for the 18 major MPOs to achieve greenhouse gas emission reductions from cars and light-duty truck trips for 2020 and 2035. Draft targets are due by June 30, 2010, and final targets are due by September 30, 2010. While this bill is silent on the process ARB will use to set targets, ARB staff anticipates that it will use a series of public workshops culminating in an official review and approval by you as governing board. This process will be similar to ARB's draft scoping plan for the climate change program. In this case, the draft targets will be presented to you as an informational item in June of 2010, and final targets will be presented to you for a vote in September. ARB must update the regional greenhouse gas emission reduction targets every 8 years. ARB may revise the targets every 4 years if it feels new information, technologies, or modeling techniques warrant a revision to the targets. Each MPO will prepare a sustainable community strategy as a component of its regional transportation plan, known as an RTP. This strategy will act as the land use element of the RTP and will prescribe how the region intends to meet its greenhouse gas target. It must use transportation air emission modeling techniques consistent with the guidelines prepared by the California Transportation Commission to document greenhouse gas emissions. ARB is required to review an MPO's methodologies and comment on any techniques that may need to be refined or corrected. If ARB determines that a region's sustainable communities strategy will not meet its target, the MPO must prepare an alternative planning strategy. The alternative strategy must also be submitted to ARB for approval. Projects already programmed in the statewide transportation improvement program through 2011 and certain voter-approved projects are exempted from the provisions of the bill. Prior to the enactment of SB 375, there was poor coordination between housing planning and transportation planning cycles, and the current law creates incentives to understate population projections for one purpose and overstate population projections for the other. Under SB 375, each MPO would be required to update their regional housing needs assessment every 8 years instead of every 5 years, as required by current law. This will ensure the housing needs process will incorporate the same assumptions and strategies as the RTP, which federal law requires to be done every 4 years. All of these regional planning components must be consistent. Finally, SB 375 provides incentives to developers in the form of CEQA streamlining. Residential and mixed-use projects that are consistent with an ARB-approved sustainable community strategy or alternative strategy will not have to be analyzed under CEQA for growth-inducing impacts, impacts on global warming, or impacts on the regional transportation network, and a limited set of projects that meet certain environmental and other criteria would have streamlined CEQA analysis. The governor also signed SB 732 by Senator Steinberg, which complements SB 375. That bill provides a comprehensive framework to implement the new programs under Proposition 84, the $5.4 billion initiative voters passed in 2006 related to water, resource protection, and park improvements. The bill establishes the Strategic Growth Council composed of state agency heads and one public member. Most important to the successful implementation of SB 375, the council will manage $180 million that is available as grants and loans to support the planning and development of sustainable communities. Of this, $90 million is available to assist regional and local governments in planning activities related to 375. Now I move on to the budget and other legislation. The budget continues to reflect the governor's and the legislature's commitment to reduce global warming and air pollution. This year's budget supports ARB's need to staff up to meet the challenges imposed by AB 32. ARB has already received 125 new positions dedicated to climate change activities. This year's budget authorized an additional 27 to bolster AB 32 and the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. Enforcement efforts were enhanced by 37 new positions, primarily reflecting an emphasis on effective enforcement of regulations to reduce diesel exhaust emissions. Related incentive programs to reduce pollution from goods movement and other emission sources were expanded by 22 new slots. The budget also includes an appropriation that will continue progress on the hydrogen highway. This year's budget added a $6 million installment that will be used primarily to leverage additional public and private investment in our hydrogen fueling infrastructure. As usual, the budget was accompanied by a series of budget trailer bills that affect ARB programs. Trailer Bill AB 1338 adds authority for the state to use loans and loan guarantees under the Proposition 1B incentive program. That program originally only allowed the state to award funds as grants. We expect to recover some capital that will extend the capacity of the program in future years through the return on loans. In addition, we hope to leverage additional private sector funds by enhancing credit with loan guarantees and using private sector lending institutions. AB 1338 also dedicates $48 million from the Air Quality Improvement Program created last year by AB 118 to provide financial assistance with ARB's on-road truck regulations. Like the Prop 1B program, it allows ARB to leverage funds through loans and loan guarantees. It also requires priority funding for financial hardship and for short-haul trucking like port drayage and other small trucking businesses. AB 1338 also expanded on the obligation of Cal EPA to prepare an annual report card on state agency efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The report card must include a 5-year work plan summary and a budget display for each state agency implementing climate solutions. In addition, the report card is to be submitted to the legislature in conjunction with the governor's budget due January 10 each year. The bill also blocked PUC's unilateral effort to establish a climate change research institute, but I'll talk about more about this later. In the interest of time, I want to briefly mention several other important bills, almost headline style, that were signed into law, and I'd be happy to provide more detail following today's meeting on any of these. Beginning again with global warming, ARB sponsored AB 2991 by Assemblymember Nunez to add the climate change expertise to ARB's research screening committee. Earlier today, you began that process, just before me, in fact, with the designation of climate experts to serve on the research screening committee. ARB's enforcement will be enhanced by another bill that ARB sponsored, AB 2922, authored by Assemblymember and former board member Mark DeSaunier. This bill updates the health and safety codes to specifically include enforcement authority for new mobile source programs. I must add that it was certainly a pleasure to work with Mr. DeSaunier in his new role, and I look forward to similar relationships with any future former board members who may find themselves in the legislature.
Should that occur.
Should that occur. This year's session also produced legislation dealing with the growing concern about the chemicals that have become so common in every household. AB 1879 by Assemblymember Feuer and SB 509 by Senator Sumitian direct the Department of Toxic Substances Control to inform the public about toxic risks in consumer products and to embark on a program to reduce exposure. This new program will involve the work of several agencies, including ARB, and dovetails well with efforts to improve indoor air quality. And the San Joaquin Valley will benefit from Assembly Member Arambula's AB 2522, which empowers the San Joaquin Air District to increase their motor vehicle registration surcharge from the current $6 to as much as $30 to reduce pollution from mobile sources. The appointment process for city representatives on the San Joaquin Valley District Governing Board will be clarified by Senator Flores's SB 1548, which sets up a process and committee to take on the task. Finally, the South Coast Air District can continue its good work under the Clean Fuels Program with a continuation of the $1 motor vehicle registration surcharge. Senator Padilla's SB 1646 established permanent authority for this surcharge that raises $12 million annually for clean vehicle grants. Looking ahead, I'll mention a few high priority air quality issues that we will be working on next session. One of this session's major disappointments was the failure to reach agreement on legislation that could have raised over $200 million annually to reduce pollution related to the movement of containerized cargo from the state's ports through the state's trade corridors. That bill was Senator Lowenthal's SB 974. Although many differences were resolved in negotiation during the final days of the session, agreement was not reached and the governor vetoed the bill. It's possible, but not certain, that this issue will be reintroduced and the dialogue can be resumed. And of course, more climate change legislation is anticipated. There is intense legislative interest in the scoping plan you will consider shortly. I'm sure there will be legislation in response to that. But other climate-related bills may address the coordination of research efforts. This past session, SB 1762 was authored by Senator Parada in response to a PUC proposal to create a climate research institute. This bill attempted to define climate change research responsibilities, but was vetoed. We remain hopeful that something can be worked out next year. Other greenhouse gas issues likely to be active next year include offset policy, low carbon fuels, and a growing interest in facilitating the growth of green jobs. As you've seen, the proposed AB 32 scoping plan calls for a 33% renewable portfolio standard from the state's energy providers. Current law requires 20% from investor-owned utilities by 2010. Senator Simitian's SB 411 would have enacted a 33% renewable portfolio standard for all retail sales of electricity, but that bill stalled in the Assembly. However, interest remains strong to increase the renewable portfolio standard above the 20% in existing law, and this is underscored by the recommendation for a 33% RPS in the proposed scoping plan. And leadership in both houses of the legislature recognize the importance of a more aggressive RPS. In fact, the Assembly has created a work group chaired by Assemblymember Krikorkian to address the issue. The bill to improve the small check program also floundered. SB 616, sponsored by the Sacramento Air District and SEEB, and carried by Assemblymember Jones, was held in the Senate during the last weeks of the session. This bill would have required an annual small check for vehicles that are 15 model years or older. Vehicles older than the 1976 model year would remain exempt from small check, as would vehicles that are likely to pass a small check. We owe Sacramento Air Pollution Control Officer Larry Green a debt of gratitude for taking the lead on this legislation and dedicating the resources needed to take a good run at it. We need to improve the effectiveness of the program, and it will take legislation to do that. Hopefully, the effort will be more successful next year. SB 375 was a great accomplishment, but even as it was signed, it was acknowledged that cleanup legislation would be necessary, so we will see additional work on that as well. And finally, Congress has been working to develop climate change legislation. There is great optimism that real progress can begin with the next administration. The ARB, CalEPA, and the Governor's Office are taking an active role to help shape federal climate change legislation. We are very fortunate to add a talented staffer to the Governor's D.C. office to work on climate change issues. Brian Turner had worked with the ARB and other environmental groups before joining the administration, and has proven to be a very valuable addition. In addition to action on specific bills, the legislature held 10 special hearings related to air pollution issues, and that doesn't include the three this week. The topics were diverse, but particular attention was devoted to renewable fuels and energy and global warming. In addition to formal special hearings, ARB provided many, many individual briefings to legislators and staff. All of the air quality bills, along with veto and signing messages and a listing of the special hearings, are presented in our annual legislative report. You should have this report before you, and copies are available here for members of the public. The report can also be accessed online at ARB's website. This concludes my presentation. Thank you for your attention, and on behalf of the entire legislative office, I want to thank the chairman, Mr. Goldstein, the executive office, and program staff for their steadfast support.
Thank you very much, Mr. Oglesby. It was a very busy year. They usually are, but I think this one resulted in a couple of really major accomplishments, as well as you indicated, some disappointments as well. It was also just interesting to look at the sheer number of bills that were introduced in our area. I don't know how it compares with other topics, but it seems to me like it's an awful lot to be tracking. Board members have questions or comments? Ms. Kennard?
Thank you. I had a question, I guess, and also kind of an editorial comment about SB 375. It kind of reminds me of the old kind of jobs-housing balance, where there was a movement to try to get people to work and live in the same community, which was really not a successful program because you couldn't force the market to invest in jobs, in particular in outer-lying areas. So I'm assuming that this new legislation is trying to get the transportation network out to where people live so that they can more effectively get into workplaces. Is that the intent from a planning perspective?
It's more focused at making sure that communities are livable and that they're less motor vehicle based, that you have walkable communities, you have essentially a community that can meet the residents' needs, and they're high quality, attractive communities.
that are less dependent on the automobile travel.
So within, like, I'm thinking of the Inland Empire, which is very suburban, very car-dependent for everything you do, shopping, recreation. So what's the idea is to have new communities that are designed more on a pedestrian-friendly configuration?
That would be one tool, but there are other tools available. I mean, essentially, transit is another way of linking areas, a more aggressive and complete transit system. But it's really a forward-looking planning process that allows the regions to design communities in a way that makes most sense to those communities. And it won't be uniform throughout the state. Some areas are vastly different in the circumstances and the conditions. And what you are empowered to do is, in setting the greenhouse gas regional targets for them to meet, is to consider the circumstances that exist in each of those regions, and then empower the regions to work with those targets to make development plans that make sense.
But just to be clear, all the resources board does is establish the number based on process, and then it's up to the regions to do the aligning of their housing, land use, transportation plans, and there's basically just two incentives in it and no clubs. Which was one of the criticisms that came from some, I know, from the environmental side who wanted there to be real hammers. So all that's in 375 is the potential for more funding if you do have a transportation plan that meets your sustainability goals, and for the developer community, an incentive in the form of an expedited or relaxed CEQA process for your project if it's within the plan. So hopefully that overcomes some of the obstacles that have been there in the past to moving people in this direction. But we're still a long way from having anything in place. I think what was really the inspiration for this was the Sacramento Blueprint, which has clearly established itself as a success tool at the local level for helping developers decide on projects that fit more within the goals of walkability, livability, et cetera, and achieved, I think, the broadest level of consensus that I've ever seen about what the growth pattern should be. But it's going to be a long process, and I don't think anybody feels like it's the panacea. But at least from a process perspective, it seems like it builds on some sound learning about what works and what doesn't work in these areas.
So the local planning agencies are like STAG, the regional authorities. Those will be the planning participants as opposed to every local city.
Right. Just briefly, there's 18 MPOs involved, and in the SCAG region, there's special provisions for sub-regional plans to be developed from a sustainability standpoint, and then SCAG has this responsibility to try to coordinate those. So it's going to be extremely challenging in the Southern California region. And
that could be a whole career for somebody.
Yeah. Thank you. Comments, questions? Yes, Ms. Diadamo first, and then Ms. Burke.
Well, I have a lot of questions about SB 375, but I don't want to take up time today except to in just one area, and that is on the targets.
Sure.
As I understand it, this advisory committee will come up with recommendations. They'll bring those recommendations to our board, and we will adopt regional targets.
Yes. Maybe just a clarification on the advisory committee's charge actually is to look at methodologies and not to recommend a specific target. What the bill does, however, has a very, very back and forth kind of a process where the ARB staff is to share technical information, including the types of information that would come out of the advisory committee process. The MPOs may propose a target they would like us to consider. So I think it's very valuable that there's a lot of ground-up participation embedded in this process as we go forward.
Okay, and then I would just note, I know we're going to be talking about AB 32 later, but on the chart that provides targets for the various sectors, the regional transportation-related targets, which is this area here on local land use and transportation,
indicates that the number that we have in the report represents an estimate of what may be achieved for land use changes, but it's not the SB 375 regional target. So those regional targets could go higher or lower, correct?
That's exactly right. And we were very, in the staff presentation, to be clear, that we took the median number or the middle number in terms of the academic studies out there that focus really on just the fundamental relationship between transportation, land use patterns, and vehicle miles traveled. But certainly if other considerations such as congestion pricing and a lot of other mechanisms mm-hmm. are put in the mix, that you can get much greater benefits. And we certainly, we as staff expect that once we get through this regional planning process, we'll do much better.
And so just food for thought for the other board members, I think that it's important, since we're going to be adopting this in December, that we hit a high target, because although we could at a later time go higher or lower, I think it's important to hit a fair, reasonable, high target so that those regional plans can fold into it, because I think that process is going to get very complex, especially as regions fight for, well, certain regions fight for status quo as much as possible.
Yes.
Ms. Bird?
No, sorry. I said yes. They are leverage.
Just a quick comment about 375, then four quick questions, Rob, if you could pursue them. I guess my premise is that local governments are rational decision makers. You put incentives, and we will respond. And I do think in the SCAG region, the RTP is an example of getting very diverse priorities together in a generally accepted plan. Four quick questions. One is the budget numbers of new people. I think that can't be very often. If you look across the state bureaucracy, there's not very many places where you have an increase in staff positions. Just a quick comment on that. Second, I was just curious how many bills that we sponsored out of all these that are in this booklet that actually had CARB sponsorship connected with it. Third, if you just help maybe the board members understand how, if CARB takes a support opposed position, how that position emerges. And then on SB 974, I take it from Alan Longfellow's weekend, it's going to be coming back. And in my own judgment, we kept moving the goalposts on the senator. And it does seem to me that if CARB has a role, we should be involved earlier rather than keep moving the goalposts. So.
Well, cue me up as we go through the answers to the questions. But yes, it is unusual, particularly in this budget cycle, to get an augmentation of that generous amount to a state agency's budget. It reflects the priorities of the administration, the task before us, and also the support in the legislature, which put these duties upon us and the expectations that we will implement them successfully. It's also important to note that the funding source for those positions are not from the general fund, they're from special funds. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the AB 32 efforts is a decision that will come before this board to develop and adopt a long-term self-funding mechanism that will not only carry forward the program, but will help pay back the loans, because it's been operating on loans. In terms of the number of sponsored bills that ARB had, we had two official sponsored bills, the two I mentioned in the report, one on enforcement and the other on the research screening committee. We also sponsored the element in the budget that provided more latitude on doing grants and loans and financial credit instruments for the Prop 1B funds. The question about how do we develop a position?
Support or oppose on the legislature? Just maybe you could just help the board members.
Essentially, the development of a support or opposed position is something that comes out of consultation internally with the executive office and the chairman. A formal position that we can take is we are part of the administration. I serve at the pleasure of the governor, as does the board.
And the only positions that we are authorized to take or bills that we are authorized to sponsor are those that receive the approval of the governor's office. And so we're part of a much larger and a much larger organization that reflects a number of diverse interests, not all of which are always perfectly aligned with our worldview. And the process in the governor's office is one that tries to sort through those different values and program priorities and comes forward with a position. On 974...
You might just want to take my comments as editorial. You don't need to respond if you don't want to.
Other comments, or yes?
I'd like to add to the discussion on the SB 375. You know, I see that as a tremendously important, one of the most important bills, laws that have been passed, and the fact that there has been the support, you know, across the state, I really see it as representing a attitude that we really need to do something about our cities and our growth. And climate change is certainly an important part of that, but there are other forces at work there and support for it. And, you know, I would note that this is important not just for California, but for the U.S. and perhaps even beyond, because what we do here, this is seen as a model. And it's, you know, just like a lot of what we're doing here, sometimes it's kind of scary. But, you know, we're taking the lead here in California in this area, and it's incumbent upon us to really try to get it right. And the importance of it is that, you know, if you look at vehicle travel growth, I don't know the numbers for California, but nationally, it's the vehicle growth is expected to more than double by 2050, and it would be even higher for California. And so if we're really serious about reducing greenhouse gases, this has to be a very important part of that plan and of that strategy. And so as we go forward to kind of support what, you know, Board Member Didi Diadamo said, you know, we need to think about how 375 links up to AB 32 and in the some of the targets that we're talking about. So I'm just emphasizing that, you know, this is, you know, we do need to take this, especially as something very important, in that it does go beyond just CO2 and greenhouse gases.
Thank you for the comment, and I agree with it. I would also add that given the rather slow rollout of 375, there's a lot of time for involvement by members of the board in the process, and I thought about creating a committee and then decided really this was something that would be advantageous if everybody on the board could take some role in. So I'm hoping that the staff will be coming back to us shortly with a schedule of events going forward, and that there'll be at least one or two that all of us will be able to participate at the regional level. I think having participated in the final discussions about the bill and the discussions in the governor's office right before he signed it, there's a lot of goodwill going into this. The fact that there was this coalition, really remarkable coalition of people from the building industry, local government, and from environmental organizations coming together and agreeing that something needed to be done and that this was a compromise that people could actually work with is very heartening. But we're already seeing, as Ms. Diadamo's comments indicated, people starting to question, what does that number mean and what is AIB doing? And, you know, every step we take is going to be fraught with difficulty, I'm sure. So this is going to require everybody's help and involvement to actually make it work. Thank you. And we do have some public comment, apparently. Okay. Nidia Batista from the Coalition for Clean Air on the legislative report.
Good morning, Chair, members of the board. I just want to take this opportunity, since we're talking about legislation, to mention that last year, during session, there was a bill passed, SB 719, which would add a doctor and a scientist along with additional city representation to the San Joaquin Valley Air District Board. We have our doctor on that board now, and I should compliment Dr. Tellis as well as former ARB board member Judy Case, because there was an incident at this past hearing medical emergency, in fact, and it was really great to at least have a doctor in the building that was actually able to tend to the issue. But obviously his role on the board in terms of providing that medical expertise is just so valuable, especially in that valley. But I did want to mention that the scientist seat is still vacant, and we're approaching the end of October, and that seat still remains vacant, and so just want to ask that to the extent that this board and the leadership of this agency can put some pressure to the proper folks at the administration. I know that that region is really looking for that scientist, and we're very aware of a couple of candidates who are very well qualified, who live in the valley, and so we're really concerned about why there's been a delay, but I want to urge you to press the administration to make that appointment.
Thank you. As I think Mr. Ogilvie's comments illustrated, we actually are the administration, for better or for worse. But we appreciate your comment and are hopeful that there will be an appointment soon. If there are no further comments on this item, we'll move on to the next one. Okay. Believe that we now get to look at the proposed climate change scoping plan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members. Today, staff will present California's proposed scoping plan. It took the collaborative efforts of hundreds of people to get it to this point. ARB started putting the foundation together well over a year ago through workshops, seeking ideas through public solicitation, and at scores of stakeholder meetings to create the draft scoping plan that was released in June. 90,000 downloads of the draft plan in the first week after its release let us know our work was being watched around the world. Since then, hundreds of Californians took the time to attend the workshops and community meetings we held on the draft plan, giving us their suggestions throughout the process. In addition, thousands of people communicated with us either in person or by posting comments on ARB's website. Our partners on the climate action team, in local government, in the legislature, on the Economic and Technology Advancement Advisory Committee, the Environmental Justice Advisory Committee, and the Market Advisory Committee all provided comments and recommendations as we built the proposed scoping plan from the ground up. All of these comments and suggestions were reviewed as staff worked through the updates and the revision of the document. This will be the first of three board meetings at which we will discuss the proposed scoping plan. Today, staff will review the key elements of the plan. At our November board meeting, staff will provide more detail about the key issues in the plan. And finally, at the December board meeting, we will present the proposed scoping plan to the board for approval. Now I'd like to ask Kevin Kennedy from our Office of Climate Change to begin the staff presentation. Dr. Kennedy.
Thank you, Mr. Goldstein. Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the board. Today I am here to discuss the proposed climate change scoping plan, which we released last week. Although it has been clear for some time that we must address climate change, it seems like almost every week there is new evidence that climate change is a serious problem that demands immediate attention. Just this Sunday, the Sacramento Bee had a story on the shrinking of the Lyell Glacier and other glaciers in the Sierra. This is just one more in a long series of reports from California and throughout the world about the rapid advance of climate change. As the governor has said, the time for action is now. The scoping plan provides the framework for the bold actions that California must take to help address this global problem. The proposed scoping plan takes advantage of the maximum feasible and cost-effective measures to reduce California's greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. The mix of a cap-and-trade regulatory program and complementary direct measures provides a model for our regional partners, for our national program, and for international efforts. Our analysis shows that the plan will have positive impacts on the state's economy. The efficiency measures called for in the plan will reduce what we all spend on energy, much of which comes from outside of California. Those funds can then be spent on goods, services, and products in California, boosting our economy. There is far more economic opportunity in acting now than there is risk, and investors are poised to invest in California's growing green technology industries. Our analysis also shows that the scoping plan will build on our existing clean air program, continuing to improve air quality-related public health statewide. In my presentation today, I will provide a brief overview of the proposed scoping plan and then discuss the major issues and how we address them. And finally, I will discuss the next steps as we move toward adoption of the plan in the coming months and focus on the implementation of the plan in the coming years. This slide gives an overview of the AB 32 timeline. Since AB 32 was signed in September of 2006, we have been very busy and have to date met every milestone in the statute. In 2007, the board identified a list of discrete early actions and has already adopted regulations to implement two of those measures. Last year, the board also approved mandatory reporting regulations and established the 1990 baseline of 427 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalents. This baseline serves as the 2020 target for the scoping plan. The next major milestone is consideration and adoption of the scoping plan, which must happen by January 1, 2009. ARB and our sister agencies then have 2 years to adopt the needed regulations to implement the plan, with all the programs to be launched by January 1, 2012. As you know, we released the draft scoping plan in June. We spent the summer soliciting input on the draft plan in a series of workshops, community meetings, and meetings with a wide variety of stakeholders. We also received thousands of comments from the public. We worked with the other state agencies on the climate action team to evaluate these comments, and we continued to monitor other climate change programs regionally, nationally, and internationally. In addition, both the Environmental Justice Advisory Committee and the Economic and Technology Advancement Advisory Committee met and provided formal comments on the draft scoping plan. We continued to evaluate the draft scoping plan over the summer and released the supplemental evaluations that showed the draft plan would have beneficial impacts on both the economy and public health last month. Overall, these efforts culminated in the release of the proposed scoping plan last week. We are still receiving comments on the assumptions and methodologies used in the supplemental analyses, and will update the board in November on these analyses. For the economic analysis, we also chose to initiate a formal peer review process like that we've used for many previous regulations. We expect to receive comments later this month from the members of the peer review panel, and will update the board on that part of the process next month as well. The recommendation in the plan, like in the draft scoping plan, is a mix of complementary strategies that combine market-based regulatory approaches, other regulations, voluntary measures, fees, and potential monetary and non-monetary incentives. In developing the recommendations, we looked at the contribution of each source or source category, and the emission reduction strategy we are proposing calls for emission reductions from every sector. The key elements of the recommendation include even more aggressive energy efficiency programs. Although California has been a long-time leader in energy efficiency, we can and must find ways to expand these programs to include more households and businesses. ARB will work with the Energy Commission, the Public Utilities Commission, utilities, and other stakeholders to ensure that all Californians, including low-income households and small businesses, have access to the full range of energy efficiency programs. We also recommend an increase in renewable energy resources from the current requirement of 20% in 2010 to 33% by 2020. A central feature of our recommendation is a cap-and-trade program developed in California that will link to the Western Climate Initiative partner programs. As I will discuss later, this program will set a firm cap on the greenhouse gas emissions in the largest sectors, electricity, transportation, and industrial sources, providing a cost-effective means to achieve emission reductions. We also recommend regional targets for transportation-related greenhouse gas emission reductions. As was just discussed, last month the governor signed SB 375 that puts in place a process for setting regional greenhouse gas-related transportation targets and doing sustainable land use and transportation planning. For the scoping plan, we estimated the potential greenhouse gas reductions using published data on the fundamental relationship between land use and vehicle use and the ability of good planning to reduce vehicle miles traveled.
As SB 375 is implemented, the regional targets, with the reductions that accrue statewide, will replace the initial estimate we included in the plan. It will also be critical for ARB to continue our progress in implementing our existing policies and programs. Emission reductions from the PAVLI program continue to be a significant portion of the reductions we are counting on to meet our 2020 target. Although we believe that California will ultimately be able to implement the PAVLI greenhouse gas standards, the proposed scoping plan also describes a backup measure to obtain equivalent reductions from mobile sources. ARB is investigating a fee-based program to replace the PAVLI program if we are unable to enforce the PAVLI regulations, or to obtain additional reductions from the transportation sector. We have initiated a research contract to analyze the benefits from the implementation of fee-based in California, both in place of and in addition to the PAVLI standards. The plan also recommends targeted fees. For example, ARB is proposing a public goods charge on water to help fund efficiency improvements in the water sector and other actions that reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the water sector. We are also proposing a fee on high global warming potential gases. We are also pursuing a fee on greenhouse gases to help fund the state's administration of the climate change program itself. We plan to hold an initial workshop for that rulemaking on this fee in the near future, and plan to bring the fee regulation to the board early next year so that we can start collecting the fee in the 2009-2010 fiscal year. This slide provides a graphic illustration of the reductions in the proposed scoping plan. The two columns show projected emissions in 2020 under business as usual conditions on the one side or with implementation of the scoping plan on the other. In between, we list the various emission reduction measures included in the plan. As you can see, the measures in the plan would achieve a 174 million metric ton reduction. The majority of emissions and emission reductions are actually in sectors included in the cap and trade program. The proposed scoping plan is a stronger plan than the June draft. This plan is built on the principle that the most effective way to curb emissions and promote economic growth is through the implementation of a comprehensive set of strategies. However, the proposed plan benefits from additional analyses, expertise, and public input. This slide summarizes the key changes from the June draft. We received numerous comments that the plan should include a margin of safety in case our regulatory efforts fall short of our current estimates. For capped sectors, the firm cap provides certainty that the needed reductions will be achieved. For example, even if our energy efficiency efforts fall short of the targets we've set, total emissions from all sources in the program would still be limited due to the cap in the cap and trade program. We have also incorporated additional measures in the uncapped sectors, and these equate to a 20% margin of safety for the uncapped sectors. We received many comments about the regional transportation targets, with almost everyone advocating for a more stringent target than the 2 million metric tons we included in the draft. We worked with UC Berkeley's Transportation Sustainability Research Center and to evaluate over 20 existing modeling studies, including four from California's largest metropolitan planning organizations, to see if a larger target was achievable. Based on this work, we have more than doubled the transportation-related greenhouse gas target to 5 million metric tons in 2020. We made clear, however, that this estimate is not the specific target called for in SB 375, as was just discussed, which will be established after further deliberation, including input from the new advisory committee and public consultation with the metropolitan planning organizations. To emphasize the important role of local government, the proposed plan encourages local governments to develop climate change plans themselves and to set a goal that parallels the state goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions to 15% below today's levels, about a 30% reduction from the business-as-usual levels in 2020. After further review of the measures under evaluation in the draft scoping plan, we have added four additional direct regulatory measures that address industrial sources. Two of these measures focus on refineries and would reduce refinery flaring and remove the methane exemption for volatile organic compounds at refineries. The other two measures address fugitive emissions from oil and gas extraction and transmission. We worked closely with our colleagues at the Integrated Waste Management Board to reevaluate measures in the recycling and waste sectors. Based on that reevaluation, we have incorporated additional measures that emphasize the importance of addressing not just the methane emissions from landfills, but also ways to reduce the materials that go to landfills. These measures will encourage commercial recycling and the movement towards a zero-waste future. After further evaluation, we are also recommending a fee on high global warming potential gases to complement the regulatory program. Most emissions from these gases are not included in the cap and trade program, but we believe that placing a price on these gases can help send a market signal, discouraging use and encouraging the development of innovative alternatives. Revenues from the fee could be used to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions, either from these compounds or from other sectors. We also included in the plan a de minimis emissions threshold as required under AB 32. The recommended threshold is 0.1 metric tons annual emissions per source category. ARB and other agencies implementing measures should carefully consider this de minimis level in developing the regulations and only regulate smaller source categories if there is a truly compelling necessity. Finally, we added a section to the plan that looks beyond the reductions needed to meet the 2020 target to see whether the emission reduction measures set California on the trajectory needed to do our part to stabilize climate. This section looks to the 80% reduction by 2050 that the governor has called for and examines what policies are needed to keep us on track through the 2020s. Moving on to the cap and trade system and other particular measures in the scoping plan. As I mentioned, a key component of the plan is a California cap and trade program linked to programs established by our partners in the Western Climate Initiative. A cap-and-trade program provides certainty that greenhouse gas emissions will be reduced by imposing a firm cap on future emissions. We recommend that the program would include two sectors initially, electricity and industrial sources, when launched in 2012. Transportation and the commercial and residential use of natural gas would be added in 2015, bringing the emissions under the cap to 85% of California's greenhouse gas emissions. I will say a bit more about some of the key design features a bit later in this presentation. The California Public Utilities Commission and the Energy Commission have been conducting a joint proceeding to provide recommendations to ARB on implementation of AB 32 in the electricity and natural gas sectors. The commissions both approved the recommendations to ARB last week. Their recommendations for these sectors address details of the cap and trade program and other parts of the program that we will be considering in the context of all of California's economy. As we move forward to develop our regulations, we will work closely with both commissions to ensure that the overall program will work well for the electricity and natural gas sectors. We will also work closely with our partner states and provinces in the Western Climate Initiative. We will be developing the regulations for the cap and trade program under our authority under AB 32, but we will be doing so in a way that will allow creation of a regional market that will provide much greater emission reductions than would be possible if California acted alone. By working regionally, we can leverage our commitment to aggressive greenhouse gas reductions into a strong regional program. We also believe it is critically important to include complementary measures directed at emission sources that are included in the cap and trade program. These measures are designed to obtain cost-effective reductions while accelerating the necessary transition to the low-carbon economy needed to meet the 2050 target. The low-carbon fuel standard and the renewables portfolio standard help directly transform the energy supply mix in California, while efficiency mandates can help overcome market barriers to achieving the maximum cost-effective reductions possible. All three of ARB's advisory committees, the Market Advisory Committee, the Environmental Justice Advisory Committee, and the Economic and Technology Advancement Advisory Committee, recognize the benefits of including these types of complementary measures in addition to putting a price on carbon emissions. In the uncapped sectors, ARB and our state agency partners will be pursuing a variety of measures. In the industrial sector, ARB will be developing regulations to address fugitive emissions from oil and gas extraction and transmission. ARB will also develop regulations to reduce emissions of high global warming potential gases, from both new products and existing banks of these gases. ARB will work with our sister agencies to ensure that forest sequestration remains robust, to reduce emissions through better management of our waste streams, and to encourage methane emission reductions at large dairies. Successful implementation of the plan will mean significant energy savings for California due to increased efficiency in buildings, appliances, and vehicles. Compared to business as usual in 2020, the measures in the plan are expected to result in significant reductions in the use of gasoline and diesel and in consumption of electricity and natural gas apart from the electricity generation. These energy savings translate into significant reductions in combustion and resulting air pollution in California, and also provide over $25 billion in savings that help drive the findings of our economic analysis. Our economic evaluation of the proposed scoping plan is based on the same methodology used in the supplemental analysis released in September. Our analysis shows that the plan will help California's economy grow while creating jobs and saving individual households money, money which can be spent to boost California's economy. The plan builds on California's 30-year track record of pioneering energy efficiency programs. The efficiency gains in the plan will offset per-unit energy cost increases, delivering annual savings of between $400 and $500 per household, including for low-income households. Businesses, both large and small, will also benefit from these efficiency improvements. And since small businesses spend a greater proportional share of revenue on energy-related costs, they are likely to benefit the most. Furthermore, businesses throughout the state will benefit from the overall economic growth that is projected to accompany the implementation of AB 32 between now and 2020. Our leadership in environmental and energy efficiency policy has already helped attract a large and growing share of the venture capital investment in green technologies. In the second quarter of 2008 alone, California dominated world investment in clean technology venture capital, receiving $800 million of the global total of $2 billion. The economic evaluation is based on the best information currently available on the measures in the plan. As we develop the measures in more detail during implementation of the plan, we will conduct more detailed evaluation of the economic impacts of the individual measures to ensure that they are all cost-effective and that the impacts are reasonable. This slide shows the basic results of our economic evaluation. As you can see, the analysis indicates that implementation of the forward-looking approach of the plan, while reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 30%, also creates more jobs and personal income than if California stood by and pursued an unacceptable course of doing nothing at all to address our reliance on fossil fuels. I should note that we are starting to receive substantive comments on the economic analysis and the public health analysis I'm about to discuss. We will have more to say on these analyses in November after we have a chance to review the comments that we receive. Our analysis of the public health benefits of the plan show that the plan's reliance on energy efficiency measures will reduce fuel combustion, leading to improved public health statewide. We estimate that implementation of the plan will avoid 400 premature deaths statewide in 2020. Combined with other health benefits, including almost 11,000 avoided incidences of asthma and lower respiratory symptoms, and 67,000 avoided lost work days, the plan will achieve $2.2 billion in air quality-related public health benefits. We also believe that there can be additional benefits from the transportation and land use measure. To the extent that better land use planning leads to more walkable communities that facilitate moderate physical activity, the plan may help to reduce serious health risks like coronary heart disease, diabetes, and obesity. As with the economic evaluation, the public health evaluation is based on the best information currently available on the measures in the plan. As we develop the measures during implementation of the plan, we will, again, conduct more detailed evaluation of the individual measures. In addition to that evaluation, we also completed a review of the potential environmental impacts from implementing the measures in the proposed plan to satisfy the requirements of the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. Because most of the measures have many implementation details to be worked out, this evaluation remains fairly broad brush. More detailed CEQA evaluations will be conducted when the measures are being implemented and more details are available. I will now discuss the major issues and how the proposed scoping plan will address those issues. During the workshops and in the comments, one of the fundamental issues was the role of the cap and trade program. How big of a role should it play in the scoping plan? Industry advocates in general believed that cap and trade should play a large role with less reliance on direct regulatory measures. Some environmental groups and the Environmental Justice Advisory Committee and CAPCOA advocated for greater reliance on direct regulations. The proposed plan strikes a balance between these two viewpoints, placing a cap on 85% of the emissions, but also recommending complementary measures where we believe they are necessary. Within the cap and trade program, the issue of how to distribute allowances, the permits to emit greenhouse gases, was the subject of much discussion. Industry generally argued for freely distributing allowances, like the European Union did in its initial trading period. Environmental groups, on the other hand, generally believed that a large percentage or all of the allowances should be auctioned from the outset, like the Northeast states are doing in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, known as REGI. The proposed scoping plan acknowledges that this is a critical issue in the design of the cap and trade program. 100% auction is a worthwhile goal for California to pursue, but there are a broad set of factors that must be carefully considered in evaluating the potential timing of a transition to 100% auction, including competitiveness, leakage, the impact on consumers, the effect on regulated versus unregulated industries, and the use of auction revenues. ARB will be seeking input from a broad range of experts in an open public process regarding options for allocation and will be coming back with more specific recommendations in the future. Offsets are surplus emission reductions that happen outside the cap and trade program. The role of offsets was also a topic of much discussion. Most business groups advocated for no quantitative or geographic limits on offsets. Most environmental groups argued for quantitative limits, while views on geographic limits varied. The Environmental Justice Advisory Committee argued that offsets should not be allowed. The proposed plan would require that the majority of emission reductions from capped sectors must come from capped sources, not offsets. Offsets would only be accepted if they met the AB 32 requirements of being real, permanent, quantifiable, verifiable, enforceable, and additional. Offsets that met those requirements could be accepted regardless of where they are generated. Use of an auction to distribute allowances has the potential to generate a large amount of revenues. 100% auction in 2020 at $10 per ton would mean almost $4 billion. The use of revenue and the closely related question of how to distribute any allowances that are not auctioned raise significant issues relating to the state distributing something of great value. Many worthwhile suggestions have been made about how to use these revenues or the value of allowances, ranging from reducing the cost of emission reductions to distributing the revenue on a per capita or per household basis to all Californians. We plan to seek input from a broad range of experts in an open public process to evaluate the options as part of the detailed design process for the cap and trade program. As an air quality agency, obviously we're very interested in how the plan will help us move toward improving air quality and public health in California. Because the plan is a broad policy document, we couldn't evaluate in detail the specific environmental impacts of particular measures or sectors. But directionally, we're heading in the right direction. Efficiency improvements in the plan will reduce fuel use and NOx and PM 2.5 emissions statewide. It is important to note that there is nothing in the plan that would encourage sources to emit more than they would in the absence of the plan. In fact, the cap and trade program, for example, will encourage covered sources to emit less by placing a new regulatory requirement, which is to surrender allowances that have monetary value for all of their emissions. As we develop the regulations and have more specific proposals, we'll be able to take a closer look at the potential air quality and environmental impacts. And AB 32 requires that, to the extent feasible, we consider direct, indirect, and cumulative emission impacts of market-based compliant mechanisms before they are included in any regulations that the board adopts. Although the scoping plan is aimed primarily at 2020, we know that it is only a way station and that the real goal is significant long-term reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. The governor has set a goal of an 80% reduction below 1990 levels by 2050. This plan puts California on the path towards that 80% reduction. We will need to pursue additional measures, measures that are logical extensions of the programs in the plan. By lowering the emissions cap in the cap and trade system, doubling the greenhouse gas emission reductions from vehicles, increasing the use of renewable energy, further reducing the carbon intensity of fuel, and increasing energy efficiency and green building efforts, and continuing to implement sound land use policies, we can continue on the glide path towards an 80% reduction in 2050. These are tough measures to take, but they are doable and necessary in the long run. We released the proposed plan and opened the CEQA comment period last week. This board meeting is the first in a series of meetings in which the board will hear discussion of the proposed scoping plan. In November, after the board and the public have had time to digest the plan, we will provide a more detailed update, and the board will conduct a public meeting to discuss the plan. ARB intends that the November meeting will be the main forum for hearing oral testimony on the plan and requests that the public consider this when planning their testimony. In December, the board will vote on the scoping plan. As you all know, the hard work isn't in adopting a plan. It's implementing the plan, or as the governor might say, the follow-through. AB 32 gives us 2 years to adopt the regulations needed to implement the scoping plan. We will follow our normal rulemaking process with ample opportunity for public input and comment. Implementation and enforcement will both play a critical role in achieving the goals of AB 32. ARB will work closely with a variety of partners in implementing this plan. We will work with local governments and regional agencies, with the state's energy agencies and other agencies of the Climate Action Team, and with our local air district partners as we evaluate how best to develop, implement, and enforce the measures in the proposed scoping plan. Another key consideration will be the potential impacts and opportunities for small businesses. We will not be successful in achieving the ambitious targets we've established for energy efficiency and other reduction measures if small businesses and low-income communities are not able to fully participate in the reductions and resulting savings that are part of this plan. Finally, we will have to come back in 5 years to report on our progress in an updated scoping plan that will provide further direction for what California must do to address the looming crisis of climate change. We all know that we cannot afford to wait to address climate change. It is simply the greatest environmental challenge of our generation and of the next generation. This plan puts California on the path towards sustainability. It illuminates the path forward that others throughout the country and throughout the world can follow to a better future for our children and our grandchildren. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy, for an excellent presentation. And before we go to public comment, I just want to make a couple of remarks. First of all, this is a phenomenal piece of work, and I just want to put it in context. I know the board received the draft of the scoping plan when it came out back in June. I think if you haven't already had a chance to read it through in any detail, you will see that although it's expanded slightly in the number of pages, it is also a far tighter, more compact, and really more readable document than it was in its draft form. As far as I can tell, this is the first comprehensive plan of its kind ever done by any governmental agency anywhere in the world. And it's therefore kind of startling in its scope and ambition. And yet at the same time, it is also really quite simple and straightforward in its approach to how to achieve the task that was assigned to us. I do want to underscore just a couple of things. First of all, as you will see, much of this plan relies on others than the Air Resources Board for its successful implementation. This is not a plan for things that the ARB is going to do all by itself. It's a plan for how the state of California, including state government, local government, and citizens together can achieve the goals of AB 32. And I think in that respect, it's quite different from anything that we've ever done before, because it is an invitation to begin a process, as opposed to the sort of plans that we normally adopt when we approve SIPs, which immediately begin to take on a regulatory power of their own. And I commend the staff for having resisted a lot of pressures coming from various of our stakeholder groups to turn this into something more like a SIP and less like the kind of blueprint that I think it was really intended to be. I think it will stand the test of time, but it will not be, years from now, it will not exist in exactly the form that it does today. It will be changed as we learn more and as we see that some things improve and others perhaps are much harder than we thought they might have been going forward. It involved, as you heard, many, many staff people, both here and in other places, as well as a tremendous amount of input from the public, including business entities that will be regulated under the proposed plan as we move forward, but also many citizens and many interested parties from both within and without California. And I think that's a real testament to the importance of what we're doing here. For those who are signed up to speak today, I just want to re-emphasize, this is not the public hearing on the plan. If you wish to be heard on the record on the plan, you need to testify beginning in November. So if you're thinking that this is your opportunity to testify and have it be part of the public record, I would urge you to forego your comments today and come back for the board's November hearing. But for those of you who do wish to make comments about the plan now, I'm going to ask you to keep them to 2 minutes because, as I indicated earlier, we're really not in a position to take action based on what you say today. So having said that, we do have 15 people who've signed up to speak here on the release of the proposed plan. I'm sure we'll be talking to them all as we move forward as well. So I'll just begin with Rachel Katz, followed by Anton Chiono, and Laura Navarro. Please come forward. And I will ask the clerk to set this for 2 minutes rather than our usual three.
Hi, sorry. Hi. Good morning, Chairman and members of the board. I'm Rachel Katz. And
I'm Anton Chiono.
We're with the Pacific Forest Trust, and we just wanted to comment briefly. Of course, we'll come back in November, have longer and more prepared comments and also written comments to submit. But we wanted to, first and foremost, quickly commend the ARB for the excellent work that went into the proposed scoping plan. The plan is an important accomplishment and critical for moving California towards a low-carbon economy. And it continues its pioneering role in demonstrating how carbon emissions can be reduced while also sustaining and stimulating the economy. PFT particularly appreciates the inclusion of forests and land use in the proposed scoping plan, the no net loss target for the forest sector, is particularly important and will ensure that future generations will also have this critical tool to maintain a healthy climate. Forests serve as a key part of the solution to global warming, but only when they are conserved, sustained, and conserved, restored, and sustainably managed. We also appreciate the inclusion of plans to establish a robust monitoring system to account for changes in the forest sector and ensure the no net loss target is met and that real and lasting gains in the sector are achieved through additional offsets.
Thank you.
So we just to wrap up.
Again, want to thank you very much for everything the ARB has done in this respect, and we greatly look forward to working with you in the future, as well as the Resource Agency and Fish and Game. And so just thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Ms. Navarro, followed by Edwin Lombard and Charles Frazier.
Good morning. Thank you for listening to me today. My name is Lauren Navarro from Environmental Defense Fund. Environmental Defense Fund applauds CARB for the impressive effort involved in producing the final scoping plan. The plan includes a robust balance of measures that will allow California to cut our emissions by 30% by 2020 and put us on a strong path towards achieving the 80% cut in emissions by 2050. As California and the world face a faltering economy, we must support policies that grow our economy and save families and small businesses money. The scoping plan will drive a clean energy economy that will not only create jobs and drive innovation and investment at home, but will give us a competitive advantage as other states and countries seek the technologies we pioneer. For example, implementing the scoping plan will create more than 100,000 new jobs and provide job training. These jobs are real. A UC Berkeley study released last week showed that California's energy efficiency policies created a net of nearly 1.5 million jobs from 1977 to 2007 and cost mere thousands. The scoping plan will also deliver tremendous cost savings for small businesses and residents throughout the state associated with reduced usage of electricity and fuels under the mix of policies recommended by the plan. And that brings me to my last example. The scoping plan will help us reduce our dependence on foreign oil by increasing our renewable energy mix and improving energy efficiency, increasing the stability of energy costs. While prices will rise slightly as a result of these policies, they would loosen the ties that have caused prices to rise dramatically as a result of our dependence on foreign oil. As an illustration, that same early investment in energy efficiency that created all of those jobs I mentioned earlier also allowed California's per energy use to remain stable, per capita energy use to remain stable, while the rest of the countries has increased by 50%, putting money in our pockets. I like that personally.
Thank you, Ms. Navarro. You have used up your 2 minutes.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Well, thank you for everything.
We appreciate your kind words. Mr. Lombard and Mr. Frazier.
Madam Chair and board members, good morning. My name is Edwin Lombard. I represent the California Black Chamber of Commerce, which is 21 black chambers throughout the state of California, also representing the California Association of Black Pastors this morning. We support the goals of AB 32, but the roadmap that CARB has proposed to achieve these goals has us worried. Our organization represents the interests of minority-owned businesses and the underserved community. When we see a plan that says right off the bat that there will be increases in prices to energy and fuel, we are worried. The fact that they say those increases will be offset by cutting back on uses is not comforting to us. In our communities, especially with our businesses, can't afford the high prices and utility prices that we already have. We've cut back as far as we possibly can. We've been asking CARB for a long time to tell us what AB 32 implementation is going to cost us in real time in the immediate future. And frankly, the staff has been very evasive. They still haven't told us where the billions of investments of high cost requiring upfront to get this thing, get AB 32 to where it's going to be, is going to come from. And we know normally these costs trickle down to the consumer and small business owners. Instead of continuing to assure us that AB 32 policies will bring venture capital and new green jobs to California, for a long time we've been asking what kind of jobs they're talking about. In the new plan, they finally give us some idea. They say that the lower income workers, like a lot of folks in our community, will bring slight increases in jobs. And these jobs are pretty much the same types of jobs that they already have, just with working for green businesses. That concerns us also. It's real disappointing in my community where employment opportunities are limited and education is a challenge. How is it supposed to inspire our kids that there's a bright future for them? We understand that there's going to be lower cost once this plan, by the year 2020, once everything gets there. Our concern is, what do we do in the interim? How do we get there? Can we stay alive and exist during that time frame? A lot of these small businesses, they month to month, they make just enough money to make payroll. They make just enough money to keep ahead of the curve. If they're required to increase their cost significantly within the first 5-10 years, they might no longer be able to do business here.
Mr. Lombard, your time is up.
Thank you.
I appreciate your comments, and we can respond in a moment. Yes, Mr. Frazier, followed by Aaron Rodgers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and board members, staff. Today I'm representing the Sacramento Black Chamber of Commerce, and you're right, Chairwoman Nichols, this is a great piece of work. But we continue to be concerned that the scoping plan even now continues to ignore the very real immediate and near to midterm costs that will impose on underserved and low-income communities. The plan uses long-term averaging to conclude that low-income families will have about an extra $400 in their pockets in 2020. With all due respect, the families in my community are struggling to pay their bills next week and next month. The promise of a few extra dollars a month, 12 years from now, is not helpful or comforting to these folks. We're also being told there will be lots of green jobs for low-income workers, but the scoping plan says these jobs will largely be in food service, agriculture, retail, and healthcare, and no new training will be required. In other words, we can expect our gas prices, our utility bills, and other costs to go up right away, but we still have the same low-paying jobs in the new green economy as we have in the old one. Not only does this fail to improve things for low-income families for at least a decade, it will probably make it worse right now, when things are already worse than they have been in a long time. It certainly doesn't inspire hope in our youth, who are already discouraged from their future prospects. The scoping plan acknowledges that low-income communities are going to need some help, but it doesn't say what form that help might take, where it will come from, and whether the cost of that help will mean increases in other costs that have to be passed along by the people who will be taxed more to pay for that help. The goals of AB 32 are worthy, and we believe there is potential for success if it is implemented in a reasonable way that takes into account the current economic crisis and the reality of the financial burdens it will impose on those least able to afford it. The plan your staff is asking you to approve doesn't do that. I hope you will send this plan back to your staff and direct them to conduct a more realistic economic analysis and come back to you with a plan that adequately addresses the near-term costs and offers more cost-effective alternatives than what is before you now. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Mr. Frazier. Mm-hmm. Let me just briefly say that I agree with you that the plan does not adequately address all the issues that you've raised. I think it alludes to them, that it requires that there be more done to fill in these blanks that you're talking about, not just with respect to small business or black-owned businesses or others, but to a whole panoply of things that are included in the plan. And it acknowledges that there's going to have to be pretty intensive work done before anything can actually be done under the plan. And I just want to reiterate that the plan itself doesn't actually require anybody to do anything, even if we were to adopt it today, which we're not going to, because we have more work to do in terms of gathering input. But it seems to me that based on the language itself of AB 32, that the board still has to go through a whole lot of work before we could actually impose any requirements on anybody, and that couldn't possibly happen, you know, for at least another year or two. So I really want to encourage you to work with the staff to develop some specific proposals. I know you've spoken with staff. I'm not saying you haven't. I appreciate the fact there's been communication. But the time is going to come for there to be now actual specific recommendations that we can plug in as we move forward to what will be done under this plan, as opposed to just the framework. That's what we're looking at right now. So I don't know if staff has anything additional that they want to add in terms of process, but I do appreciate your coming. It's not that we think this is perfect. My compliments for the plan were based on the fact that I do think it lays it out in big terms, but there's still an awful lot of pieces that have to be filled in.
Well, our offices are open from 8 to 5:30, so.
Okay, very good.
We're still waiting on those phone calls.
You'll be sitting by your phone call.
I appreciate it, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you.
Chairman Nichols?
Yes.
Could I add something to
this? Yes, sure. Go ahead.
You know, to raise the, you know, not in terms of the process, but, you know, I've been involved a lot in some of the energy efficiency studies and projects. And, you know, there was a study that came out, American Physical Society about a month ago. There's another one coming from the National Academy soon that just makes the point that there's tremendous opportunities for energy improvements in energy efficiency. And I bring that up because that in itself is going to generate huge numbers of new jobs. And that is because there are all these opportunities, and there's going to be all the incentives, you know, everything from replacing windows and insulation and so on, but to, you know, things like putting sensors in to buildings, and all of these are green-collar jobs. These are going to, you know, skilled jobs, and there's, you know, because the potential energy savings and carbon savings are huge, there's a tremendous incentive to do it, and they haven't happened, you know, for a variety of reasons, but you know, partly because there's what we sometimes call the principal agent problem where, you know, the house renter doesn't have the same incentives as the landlord in terms of reducing energy, electricity use and so on. But out of this, you know, the AB 32, and it's going to be going more through the Public Utilities Commission and the California Energy Commission, and they're already starting these kinds of programs. You know, just to highlight, just one little example, you know, at UC Davis, the parking garage, you drive by it on I-80. It's lit up in the middle of the night. You see all this light. Well, now the university is putting in little sensors, and so that if there's no one there, the reason it's lit up is because for security reasons, mm-hmm. that, you know, you don't want someone, going to get their car at night and, you know, people, you know, bad people hiding behind the columns and going to attack you or something. So, you know, it's lit up. But now they're putting in sensors. And it's going to, you know, it takes a fair amount of investment. People are going to be hired to do this, and contractors. They're going to be putting in these sensors so that the lights flash on immediately as soon as someone comes near the building at night. And this is just a tiny, tiny example. You know, through our economy, there's going to be these kinds of innovations taking place that are going to generate huge numbers of jobs. And even if there weren't an AB 32, it would make sense. But this is going to provide the motivation to do that. And so I would suggest to, you know, organizations and entrepreneurial businesses and people just thinking about this, you know, how to create these businesses and how to generate, you know, how these jobs are going to be generated and take advantage of this opportunity.
I believe that you're correct, but I would just say that I can understand that if you're out there in the community and just looking at this plan, you want to know how those jobs are going to come to your business or your community, and not just to take it on faith that there's going to be this grand, big set of opportunities. So we're going to have to find ways to, I think, put this into a form where we can really effectively deliver on the potential that's there. I completely agree with you about the potential, though. I wouldn't be doing this work, but now we're going to have to find out how to make it real.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
And I would just add, I think we need to go full steam ahead. This is a very exciting time, but our economy is in a tailspin, so folks are concerned. Mm-hmm. I think all of us are concerned. You know, if you look at the micro-analysis, all of us are concerned about what the future is going to look like. So anything staff can do before the next hearing to incorporate some of the comments that it'll be receiving, and then, you know, it's not enough time for a full-blown analysis, but somehow to incorporate some of the changes that our economy is going through right now. I know a lot of this work was done before the big economic tailspin.
Yep, fair point. Yes, Ms. Berg.
Well, and I do think that there, it is a very well-taken point that the near term and the midterm, we should be able to address that. We should be able to say what the near term and the midterm impact, not just what the 12-year impact is going to be.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to hear next. I'm sorry, is that it? Yes, thank you. Aaron Rodgers, followed by Dorothy Rothrock, followed by Christina Erickson.
Hi, my name is Erin Rogers, and I work with the Union of Concerned Scientists. I just wanted to say in response to the last couple of speakers that we do think that the proposal that staff has put forward is going to be a great economic stimulus and create a lot of jobs. It will be helpful, though, as we move into the next phase, which is this intensive rulemaking phase, to do some more in-depth economic work on how lower-income consumers will be impacted economically and also health-wise, to do some more in-depth health analysis of the different policy choices that we're faced with so that we can make really good and sound policy choices moving forward. I know we want to keep comments to a minimum, but I just wanted to say that I feel like this is a very momentous day. Our Union of Concerned Scientists worked very hard on producing a study that showed what the impacts of global warming could be to California before AB 32 was passed. We've been working for years on this, and the staff has just done an amazing job putting together a world-class, excellent plan. And I feel like we have to mark this moment in time as an important moment in history. The world is definitely watching us. We're very pleased that the scoping plan relies on strong sectoral policies for the majority of the emissions reductions we expect to get. We're very happy with increasing our renewable energy standard to 33% and relying on California's landmark clean car standards for emission reductions. We hope that the board also eventually adopts a fee-based program to go on top of those clean car standards. The main areas of concern with the plan for us,
Ms. Rogers, yes. I'm going to take over for the chairman for just a moment. You are out of time, so I just need sort of a summary sentence.
Summary. Sentence. The main areas of concern are with the cap and trade program design, especially around offsets, the use of offsets, and auctions. But we can get into that more next time.
Thank you very much, Dorothy Rothrock.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Ms. Reardon, just wave your hand when I'm 2 minutes.
Okay.
My name again, Dorothy Rothrock. I'm with the California Manufacturers and Technology Association. I'm also co-chair of the AB 32 Implementation Group, which is a coalition representing small and large businesses interested in implementation of AB 32 to support jobs and growth in the economy. And I just briefly want to talk a little bit about the economic analysis today. I won't be redundant, but I want to emphasize something that I heard earlier, that it's very important for this economic analysis to actually serve your purpose, which is to help create the best plan possible. Right now, what we have is an analysis snapshot of 2020, and we don't know how it stacks up with other alternatives, how alternative scenarios would either increase or decrease cost for the plan, nor do we know how to necessarily tell other policymakers in the state how they need to take steps or embrace policies that will mitigate costs that are going to occur in the near and long term for various elements of the plan. So we are hoping that you take a look at this analysis that we've had conducted about the economic analysis by Judson Jaffe and Jonathan Bork of the analysis group that goes through the problems they see with the current analysis, and they make some recommendations for things that we hope you could do before the next hearing on the scoping plan. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Rothrock. Christina Erickson, Tim Carmichael, Bonnie Holmstrom.
Hi. My name is Christina Erickson, and I'm with the Planning and Conservation League. And we agree that the proposed scoping plan is an important step forward in California's historic effort to fight global warming. However, we believe that there are a few components that need modification before the board approves a final document. In particular, we suggest that the board strengthens the land use component of the plan by both further increasing the numerical emission reduction target and identifying specific policy measures that the board will adopt, including an indirect source rule. Thank you very much, and we look forward to your continued support and leadership on this issue.
Thank you. Tim Carmichael? Not here. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Lydia, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, with your permission, Tim and I would like to switch spots, actually.
Oh, all right.
If that's okay.
He always likes the last one.
He shrunk a little bit. I guess it's still morning. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board again. Neva Bautista with the Coalition for Clean Air. We are very encouraged by, you know, AB 32, and I think we share that vision and encouragement with you all in terms of the potential here in implementing AB 32. However, there are some, and we also recognize there's going to be some challenges, and we want to specifically speak about the disproportionately impacted communities and how we can make that very real. And I think those were your words, Madam Chair. So I think that is really the challenge before us. How do we ensure that the mandate in the law is actually a reality in the lives of the people that are breathing this air? I think, you know, the history has shown that while there's been a lot of great efforts, both through agencies and legislative efforts to address localized impacts and disproportionately impacted communities, I think there's been increased awareness and acknowledgement about the problem, and that's been great. However, we need to match our words with some more action, and I think that AB 32 really presents this great opportunity because the law does say that those communities need to be protected and benefited. Our concern is that when you implement a market mechanism, how do you ensure that is designed in a way that really makes that real? And I think your own case study on the community in Wilmington, for example, showing that there's a potential for somewhere about 50% reduction in air pollution in that community by 2020, appropriately, most of that coming from regulations. But when there is a market mechanism in place, how do we ensure that community is best protected? So the first step really needs to be to identify these communities. I think too often we're talking about these disproportionately impacted communities and environmental justice communities, but without any real clarity about who and where we're talking about. So that process needs to be a public, transparent, open process to identify those communities. Secondly, in order to protect those communities, we need to place restrictions through this market mechanism to ensure that those communities are protected. And then thirdly, how do we ensure that those communities are benefited? Certainly through the market mechanisms, the revenues that are generated, we need to allocate and dedicate certain part of that funding to those very communities. And I think, you know, the urgent need, again, to identify these communities, but also begin in quarter one, 2009, to ensure that we're going through a process to begin those discussions about how much of the allocation needs to go to these very communities for both air pollution reductions, but also the adaptation that's going to be needed for these communities to deal with climate change. And that includes the opportunity then for those small businesses, like those mentioned by the Black Chamber, to ensure that they're also benefiting as the law states. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I know you were speaking fast, but we heard you. Ms. Holmes-Jen.
Good morning, Chairman Nichols and board members. On behalf of the American Lung Association of California, I do want to applaud the board's leadership on the challenge of global warming, and specifically applaud the release of this scoping plan. It really is truly a momentous day, and we recognize this is a groundbreaking document, represents an amazing amount of work, and it will truly move the state forward toward a healthier and carbon-free future. I just wanted to make a few specific comments about the land use piece of the plan, because this is such an important part of the plan to the public health community. As you're reviewing and considering the land use, please remember five things. First of all, that the SB 375 process that we discussed earlier, it does lay out a valuable process for establishing regional targets and promoting better planning at the local level. But we want to encourage you to not be limited by this process. There is more that you can do to take leadership on land use. Second of all, consider the importance of establishing a stronger goal, greenhouse gas reduction goal for the land use sector. We have joined with others in recommending at least doubling the goal you've put out in the draft. Third, consider the number of local governments who are already leaders in their own right in this area of greenhouse gas reduction and who truly want to and can do more and will be asking you to do more. Strong state leadership will help them be more proactive at the local level. Many want a stretch goal. Fourth, consider requiring use of strategies such as indirect source control regulations and not just putting them out there as something to be considered in the regional planning process, but actually requiring them in the plan. And fifth, please remember the multiple public health benefits from land use strategies. Communities can realize not just air quality improvement, but reduction of chronic diseases, including lung and heart diseases, reduction of premature deaths, obesity prevention, injury prevention. There's so many public health benefits that come together in this area of the plan. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. Bernadette Del Caro, Audrey Chang, Diane Bailey.
Good morning. My name is Bernadette Del Caro with Environment California. I, too, am here in support of the scoping plan and applaud the staff for excellent job so far. To keep my comments brief, one of the strengths of this plan has already been talked about, but I just want to reiterate mention of specific measures that are the most powerful in reducing global warming pollution, specifically the renewable portfolio standard, 33% by 2020. We appreciate a mention of a feed-in tariff policy that could have, if improved upon what we already have in the state right now in terms of feed-in tariffs, can be a powerful driver toward renewable energy. Also, zero-energy buildings, there's tremendous potential within the energy efficiency sectors. I do want to mention that the solar water heating program specifically mentioned in the draft plan has yet to be rolled out by the Public Utilities Commission, and we would ask Air Resources Board, sort of aside from this specific process here, to encourage the PUC to prioritize rolling that out statewide in 2009. I want to focus my comments on auctions within the cap and trade program. This is extremely important, and we think the plan needs to be tightened up a little bit with regards to this piece. The plan mentions the sheer number of public comments received so far by the board with regards to the scoping plan. We know from our organization alone at least 30,000 were generated specifically to the issue of auctions. People understand the difference between polluters making a profit off of polluting or having to pay for their right to pollute and where that money can then go to. This is the way to deliver on the potential of this plan for helping small businesses, for helping individual consumers, et cetera, transition to a clean energy economy. This is where the money comes from. And this is an incredibly important piece of the plan. We are encouraged that the draft, that this final plan here acknowledges that getting to 100% auction is the way to go, and we appreciate that acknowledgement. And we believe that through the regulatory process that you, too, will come to that same conclusion, similar to what your colleagues essentially did on the East Coast with the REGI program, that when they started off, I was very unsure how quickly they would ramp up to 100%. After taking a close look at the value of doing that, they decided that getting to 100% is important. I want to make one quick comment.
Okay, you can see your time is up.
If we could see this draft plan bookend the auctions, clarify that we will get to 100% absolutely no later than 2020, and that we'll start off at least a majority of the allowances be auctioned off. This was in the draft scoping plan, and we think that should be reinserted. Thank you.
Thank you. As I think Mr. Kennedy indicated in his presentation, we're planning on taking some time to review the issues of both allocations of allowances and how that's to be done and what the role of any revenues that are raised from that would be. This is probably the most fundamental issue about the plan, and I don't think it makes sense to just sort of state a blanket of opinion at the outset. I think there's going to be some really key issues that we're going to need to consult with experts from around the state and around the world about before we finally decide when and how we're going to be doing that allowance allocation process. Okay, Audrey Chang, followed by Diane Bailey and Danielle Osborne-Mills.
Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair and board members. I'm Audrey Chang with the Natural Resources Defense Council. With this plan, California really is leading the way and showing other states and Washington how to really tackle global warming. As Chairman Nichols mentioned earlier, this really is the first comprehensive, binding, statewide plan of its kind, and the proposed scoping plan really is the latest indication that we're really charging and moving full speed ahead. I want to thank CARB staff for all their hard work and incredible dedication over the past many, many months, and we really do appreciate the efforts there. We strongly support the plan's overall approach to tackle global warming using a complementary mix of policies throughout all of the state sectors. And we really do support the bulk of the plans, bulk of the measures included in the plan. Just one example is energy efficiency, which you've heard about. It's really an area that California has led in the past and plans to expand in the future. It's using energy more efficiently so that customers have lower bills, but it's not giving up any of the services that we desire. While there's much to commend in the plan, I just want to target or highlight just two items and areas that we think can be improved. One is the area of land use, We appreciate the increase in the land use target from the draft plan. We do believe it can and should be increased even further, and state of the science analysis from leading academics in the field project reductions in the sector of 11 to 14 million metric tons by 2020. Increasing the target will really allow us to fully realize the full benefits of better land use and transportation planning. Another area is the forest sector. We believe the target here can also be increased, and we believe it should be expanded to include demand-side measures to address decomposition of wood products. But stepping back from those details, I do want to emphasize that the scoping plan is more than a pollution reduction plan. It's an economic stimulus plan, and it's more important than ever to really make investments in clean energy solutions that will stimulate innovation, new businesses, and job creation. It's really clear that the clean energy economy is right around the corner thanks to the leadership shown in this plan. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Diane Bailey.
Good morning, Chairman Nichols, members of the board and staff, and thank you for this opportunity to comment. My name is Diane Bailey. I'm also with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and I'm here today in very strong support of California's leadership and this agency's leadership in putting forward this plan to meet the very important global warming pollution reduction goals of AB 32, as my colleague Audrey also commended you. We also appreciate the enormous amounts of effort that went into this plan by staff and other agencies and stakeholders. I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about the importance of the inclusion of public health protections in this climate plan. And I think that many of you support that concept. Not only are the public health protections required by AB 32, but it's really incumbent upon us to maximize the health benefits from global warming pollution reduction policies, given the tremendous toll on public health that global warming will have on us, and particularly in those communities that are least equipped to deal with these impacts and that are the most vulnerable. We applaud the health benefits that are quantified in this plan. I think it's an estimated 400 premature deaths that would be avoided by the co-pollutant benefits of greenhouse gas reduction measures, and that amounts to $2.2 billion, that's billion with a B, of health costs that are saved. However, there are many measures that were left out of the plan, very strong greenhouse gas reduction measures that could provide significant additional co-pollutant health benefits. About 60% more health benefits, actually, or an additional $1 billion of health savings throughout the state. And we respectfully ask you to re-examine these measures and look at adding these important greenhouse gas measures back into the plan to get these additional health benefits. Many of these measures offer significant cost savings, as outlined in the appendices to the plan. And additionally, there were several measures that were actually included in the early action measure document that was adopted by this board last year. And these measures are no longer included in the scoping plan. And so we hope these measures weren't lost in the shuffle. These are important things like cement plant efficiency improvements.
Excuse me, you have used up your time.
Okay. Thank you very much for all of the hard work.
Thanks, and feel free to submit anything else you'd like to.
We'll submit details in writing. Thank you.
Danielle Mills, followed by Arthur Boone and Autumn Bernstein, and that's the end of my list. Oh, except for Tim Carmichael. Sorry. Tim comes back.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the board. I'm Danielle Osborne Mills with the Center for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Technologies. CERT appreciates the work of the Air Resources Board in putting together a very comprehensive and groundbreaking plan to reduce the state's greenhouse gas emissions in multiple sectors. In particular, CERT applauds the ARB's inclusion of measures for renewable electricity and energy efficiency, which will undoubtedly help the state meet greenhouse gas emissions targets as well as help grow our economy. On this note, however, CERT remains concerned about the use of low natural gas price forecasts out to 2020, which do not reflect increases in natural gas prices over the last decade. The ARB's economic analysis used a price forecast of $7.49 per MMBTU in 2007 dollars in 2020. CERT, however, recommends that a more appropriate scenario would model would reflect historical trends in volatility and increases in natural gas fuel prices and model this price going up to $17 per MMBTU by 2020 in current dollars. Modeling these higher gas prices is an important issue moving forward with implementation of the scoping plan, as well as in evaluating the cost-effectiveness of additional greenhouse gas emissions reductions measures. CERT believes as a whole that AB 32 presents an enormous economic opportunity for the state of California and supports your overall efforts. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Arthur Boone, Adam Bernstein, and then Tim Carmichael.
My name is Arthur Boone. I live in Berkeley. I am the education chair of the Northern California Recycling Association. We're concerned that the interest in recycling in this plan is a little weak. Many people do not get the connection between the way that consumer materials, post-consumer materials, are managed in energy. They don't recognize the Owens, Illinois plant in Oakland, which has 600 employees. It's the largest blue-collar facility in Oakland, saves over $1.5 million a month on their natural gas bill because they use old glass as part of their furnish, making new glass. There's less energy involved. You've all driven by steel mills. You've driven by paper mills. All of these energy industries consume a tremendous amount of energy. By recycling, we save that energy. That number has been, those numbers have been calculated and floating for about 15 years. Unfortunately, the people in California at the Integrated Waste Management Board didn't start paying attention to this until about 3 years ago. And they had conversations 2 months ago that they should have had 2 years ago. And our conviction is that your staff has been deferential to their staff and their board, and so you have a report that fails to appreciate fully what recycling can do for California. If you look at that, if you look at Mr. Kennedy's fourth chart, it says recycling and waste 1%. That's because the IPCC misunderstands recycling. Recycling really belongs in the industrial sector. And what it does is it cuts industrial emissions. And we have national studies that show industrial emissions around the country. If the whole country recycled everything, we could cut industrial emissions by over 25% in this country, simply because of the fact that taking used materials to make new things uses much less energy than taking old material, virgin materials to make new things. So my grandmother was right, and I would like you all to do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you. This will be pursued further, I can assure you. Okay, Autumn Bernstein.
Good morning. My name is Autumn Bernstein. I'm representing Climate Plan, which is a coalition of organizations, many of which you've heard from already today, but also a number of grassroots organizations around the state, groups like the Great Valley Center, Green Belt Alliance, Green LA. And our exclusive focus is land use and ensuring that we're addressing the greenhouse gas impacts of land use. So I want to thank you, first of all, for your work and for your responsiveness to the input that you've heard on the land use piece, and we do very much appreciate the redoubled effort in the scoping plan to address land use. But as some of my colleagues have indicated, we do feel that this is still a target that needs some work. The analysis that CARB staff did and the reliance upon the 5 million metric ton target came from a study by Carolyn Rodier, which for very good reason relied upon existing transportation models that have been done in the past that were not designed to address greenhouse gases. And as Carolyn Rodier notes in her conclusion, the results of this study confirm that even improved travel models are likely to underestimate the reductions from land use, transit, and pricing policies because these models are simply not suited for the policy analysis demands in the era of global climate change. So we would encourage you to look at that number with a critical eye and instead consider some of the more modern transportation demand models that are being used in places like SACOG, the Sacramento region, that have much higher numbers associated with them. And this is really significant because CARB is in a leadership role on the implementation of SB 375, and the relationship between AB 32 and SB 375 is such that the leadership that's demonstrated by this board will have a profound impact on how successful we are in implementing the goals of 375. So I encourage you to embrace that leadership role which 375 has given you on this issue. And lastly, I would suggest I would ask you to consider the ways that you can strengthen the role of some additional policy tools that are referenced in the plan, such as congestion pricing, the indirect source rule, and the role of public transit. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're just under your time. It's great. Okay. And now. Good morning.
Good to see you, Chairman Nichols.
Thank you.
Tim Carmichael with the Coalition for Clean Air. I really don't need the last word. Second to last is always fine. let me start with the positive. The plan is getting better. And that's good. We're, you know, just to highlight a couple of examples of the changes that we were pleased with in this most recent version is the RPS, 33% RPS, the individual industrial sector measures, and then the targets for local government, though we think that the target for local government could be increased to 20% and still be in the reasonable range. So my colleague Nydia Batista highlighted our vision for how, you know, where this plan falls really short. And you know, we're one of the groups out there that has been pushing the staff to make it more SIP-like. You know, maybe we're one of the dwindling numbers in the state that still think SIPs are really good. But they need to be strong. And that's part of why we've been pushing for a stronger plan here, because we think it's going to be critical for the successful implementation. But Nydia mentioned that a key to success, we believe, is dedicating resources to the most impacted communities. Before you can do that, you have to do a valid assessment of where those most impacted communities are around the state. And we've been pushing hard all year to do the cumulative impacts assessment that is part of the law sooner rather than later. The staff has pushed back and said they don't have to do it until the regulations are developed. We think that's a flawed strategy. Why not do it sooner? Unless you don't have the tool or unless there's some other thing at play. We believe there's at least one good tool out there, a tool that ARB helped fund the development of. And we think not only to inform your regulatory process, but to avoid confusion around the state among the business community, with the South Coast and the Bay Area moving ahead with their own proposals for how to do cumulative impacts assessment, we think it's just so much more prudent to have a statewide approach. And finally, to end this perceived, if not real, punting that has gone on for years relative to these communities. When we weren't sure exactly what to do, this agency and many others punted. And it's time to stop that. It's time to, you know, do the best we can with what we've got. And we've got tools out there that we can start this process with. The sooner we do the cumulative impacts assessment, the sooner a lot of these other pieces that are critical will fall into place. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That concludes the public testimony. Are there any additional comments, questions from the board? No? Yes?
Just three very quick comments. I mean, one, the comment was this is the first of its kind in terms of global warming. Maybe first of the kind the state of California to do this kind of planning, particularly across different different sectors. I think that the point that was made earlier, that the economy is not the same as it was a year ago or 2 years ago, and it's, I think we're uncertain about where what we are now in recession, how deep and how long and so forth. But just one kind of tie comment back in. I know the governor indicated support for a stimulus package, and I'm not sure. I think there is national support or talking about a stimulus package, and perhaps some of the strategy of this plan could be a part of the stimulus package that's going on at the national level. So I just offer that as a way of thinking about the stimulus plan.
Well, that's a good point. Actually, although it's not directly germane to the plan, I have been talking to colleagues at the PUC, the Energy Commission, State and Consumer Services, which has an important role in doing energy efficiency work on our own state buildings, about having a proposal together for the new administration in Washington, because obviously that's going to be one of the first things they're going to be looking at. And I think energy efficiency is going to be high on the list of areas where there could be federal money, and I'd like to be in a position to be standing there with our cup out when there's money to be flowing, because I think we could do a lot with a real plan that can show how we could use the money well. So I know there is work already going on that front. Thank you for that comment, though. Mr. Goldstein, do you want to have the last word here before we move on?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Well, the next step will be the hearing, as we discussed, in November, where we'll take more public comment. We're planning on spending a whole day just on the plan. We will do what we can in response to today's comments to try to respond as well as we can. We have already reflected some of these, most of the issues that were raised today. They already are addressed in the plan, and I think it is important to remember that this is not a SIP, it is a plan, and it's providing guidance for us as we move forward into the development over the next 2 years of each individual measure, which will require a more extensive measure-by-measure analysis, both on the economic impacts and the public health impacts.
Okay, thank you. To be continued.
Madam Chair, yes. I'm sorry, but I actually had a couple of questions.
I'm sorry.
I'll try and keep it quick.
That's all right.
I'd like to know more on what else we could do on forestry and recycling, and specifically on forestry. It seems to me, since we're using a voluntary approach, if we were to just increase the targets, that would just be based upon a wish for offsets. And there are some challenges with offsets. How much percentage do we want in the area of offsets? So based on what little I know, it seems like the only way to really push further would be, say, through a public goods charge, like what we have in the utility sector, and with what's being proposed, a fee on the water side. Is there some other approach be taken?
I'll ask Lynn Terry to respond to that and give you just a very brief update on the work we've been doing in this area.
I always have to clarify on the forestry target, because it's really important to remember, and this is sort of SIP-like, that target does not incorporate offsets, because that would be double counting in SIP terms. So what that target represents is activities implementing current regulations by the Department of Forestry, along with what we hope are other policies to be developed that will ensure that we have no net loss from where we are today, because we're going in the wrong direction with the forestry accounting. Forestry accounting is a huge issue. We have a process underway with Resources Agency, CAL FIRE, Board of Forestry staff, and we've been talking with the Resources Agency about a more formal public process to really probe into the inventory issues, the tracking issues. So you'll hear more about that. I won't go further into that. But I think that'll help explore some of the questions you're posing about could the forestry target in and of itself be changed later when we have better information. So that's on the table. On the offset side, we took the urban forestry protocol in September. We're hoping to bring additional forestry protocol to the board early next year, which will, we hope, expand opportunities for the offset piece of it. So apart from the target, we do see we're trying to support technically everything we can on the quantification side to encourage a generation of potential offsets.
And then how about on the recycling piece? Any comments on options to increase the target on the recycling piece, or as the witness indicated, on the industrial side?
Edie Chang from our Office of Climate Change will respond to that.
So we've been working pretty closely with the California Integrated Waste Management Board on how to handle the recycling and waste sector. The numbers in the plan sort of reflect the midterm goals of where the waste board wants to go. In the long term, they're looking at zero waste, substantially increasing recycling in the commercial sector as well as the residential sector, and diverting from landfills from pretty much everything that can be diverted. So we're in sync with where the waste board is going on these things. Again, there's some accounting issues with trying to figure out what are the emission reductions that can be gained in those areas. Whether they happen within the state, if they're not within the state, for us it's a little more difficult to figure out what emission reductions are possible and what we can count in that area. So we're continuing to work with the Waste Board on those measures and the tons that we can count in the area.
This is, I think, an example of an area where there might be some people who would like us to just write a reg, you know, under AB 32 that would mandate something, and that has a certain appeal to it, and obviously it could be helpful in jump-starting this whole effort, but it also has some other consequences that might not be so appealing. So we're trying to steer a course here that allows for our sister agencies that have jurisdiction in this area to do their job and at the same time keep pushing in the direction of getting the most amount of control that we can out of this area. It may be that it could be written better or done better, but that's the kind of interesting juggling act I think we have to do. Dr. Tullis.
Is this working? I'm the newest member of this committee, and I'm just beginning to learn this process. But the testimony we've heard on this in the last few meetings, the thing that's most compelling to me is that some communities are potentially at risk for being worse off. And that I think from the get-go, we need I would feel very uncomfortable approving some kind of plan that doesn't protect those communities from the get-go, and that that we really need to put some more specifics rather than this vague plan that we have here, that either communities are not impacted economically or with pollution, that we have ways to mitigate against that, either funding or whatever. But I feel very uncomfortable voting for a plan that might make somebody actually worse in the state of California.
Well, actually, AB 32 prohibits us from doing that. So if the plan did that, it would be illegal and vulnerable to being overturned just for that reason alone. But I think demonstrating that there will not be any adverse impact is something that at the level of the plan is done in a sort of an abstract way because of the inability to really pinpoint, you know, drill down into exactly what measures are going to be taken where. And probably the place where this is the most difficult to do, I think, is at the level of the cap and trade program. That's where most of the attention has been focused, because people are worried that if you allow a company that has an obligation under AB 32 to buy allowances instead of making changes at its own facility, that could somehow get them or allow them to not make other changes. And so, you know, the best we've been able to say so far is that under current law, nobody's allowed to increase their emissions because of AB 32, but the question is, would they get more benefit if we did something other than a cap-and-trade program, if we did it on a facility-by-facility basis? And that's where you start to get into some of the questions. I don't see – it's very difficult to prove a negative, let's put it that way. So what we have to do is kind of deal with all the questions that have been raised and try to answer them question by question. But I think the bigger thrust, not to prolong this discussion at this point, because I think this is something that does need to have more work done on, is really, can AB 32 be implemented in a way that is better in terms of raising up those that have the worst air quality problems? You know, can we do more than claim generic benefits for public health based on the things we know are likely to happen under AB 32 and really find a way that any additional wealth that's going to be created or benefits that are going to be created as a result of this program can help to redress some of the historic inequities? And that's an area where I know there's been a lot of thinking done academically, and people who are going to want to come in and make proposals to us as we develop the cap and trade program, but I don't know that there's been much work done yet that would really be useful in terms of fleshing this out in any great detail. And excuse me for jumping in on that, but I'm seeing a nod from Mr. Kennedy if there's anything the staff would like to add to that. But I agree with you. I think everybody wants to feel secure that when we adopt this plan, we know enough to know that no community is going to get worse, and we'd like to have as much information as we can to support that view.
Chairman Nichols, I would agree with everything that you're saying and just emphasize that this is an issue that we are very much teeing up as one of the first things once the plan is adopted and we move into the rulemaking, that you know we will be looking very closely at what work is being done around the country to deal with these sorts of issues so that we can build that into the implementation of the plan as we move forward.
Madam Chair, could I just add a couple of comments? First of all, I appreciate your one of your last sentences about wanting to try to make things better for highly impacted communities. I think that's a goal we should strive for. But, and I also appreciate that the staff is going to work on this issue once we adopt the plan. But I guess my main point is following up on one of the witnesses who's, you know, it's complex dealing with potential public health co-benefits while we're trying to implement a market mechanism like cap and trade. But I guess we could try to put off dealing with the complexity down the road, or we can start dealing with it right now. And I actually would be in favor of starting sooner rather than later, because I think it's going to be a thorny issue if we don't. And I think, as the witness from, I think it was Nydia from Coalition for Clean Air mentioned, CARB has funded a mechanism for trying to identify the most impacted communities. And we heard a presentation about that at, I guess, in May or something, at a special meeting. And the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, a sister agency in Cal EPA, is funding further work with regard to cumulative impact assessment. In fact, there's a presentation, I think, probably in this building later today on that work. So I think there are tools that are being worked on right here in the state in, with Cal EPA funding, and I think we should make use of those tools. And I'm sure they can be improved on from their current state, but I think we should start using them, because I think having information about which communities are actually most impacted is a good starting point.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
We can provide a, I'll ask Chuck Shulock to provide a quick update on the status of the tool that Dr. Baum just referred
okay.
to. Thank you. That work, which is also funded by Air Resources Board, as, you know, as well as other parties, is slated to go through our research screening committee. There are review steps in the pipeline.
I used to know about. I used to be on the committee, so I definitely know about the review process.
Well, sorry. I guess my point was that tool has not yet gone through the evaluation process that's been set up to determine that it's appropriate to apply for these sorts of activities. So, I mean, that's I think in a nutshell. And I mean, we agree that there's potential, but as you said, it's a very, very complex issue, and there are some steps that need to play out, at least in our view, before it's ready to be applied.
When do you think the review committee is likely to take this up?
I actually don't.
Do we know?
I don't know that. I don't know.
I guess I would just say, I realize what the steps are in the review process, and you know, can take a long time, and some of it depends on the investigator writing. You know, responding to critiques of the first draft of the report. I've you know, been there many times. But I think this is of significant importance that we should try to not short-circuit a proper review process, but expedite it as much as possible.
Okay. I will take it upon myself also to pursue that with the committee if need be. I think people can appreciate the fact that this is an area of significant concern, and we want to do it right, so we don't want to short-circuit anything either. Okay. Then I think we're ready to move on to the next item, unless anyone has additional comments. We're going to be spending a lot of time with this scoping plan in November and December. We next turn to an informational item on environmental indicators in California relating to climate change. I'm assuming we're just going to plow right through without taking a break because we really have two relatively short items, if that's okay with the court reporter. Okay, good.
Thank you, Chairman Nichols. Give people a moment to set up.
We need a couple of changes of staff here. We're being joined by some colleagues from OEHA.
Chairman Nichols, board members, environmental indicators are measurements that track environmental conditions over time using objective scientifically based tools. These indicators improve our understanding of the environment and how human activities and other factors can influence it. As lead agency for the environmental protection indicators for California projects, OEHA has been asked by CalEPA with developing an environmental indicator, developing environmental indicators relating to climate change. This presentation will outline OEHA's current process of identification, development, and classification of climate change-related environmental indicators, and will also summarize how these indicators can be used. Carmen Milanes from OEHA will make the presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the board. My name is Dr. George Alexeyev. I'm Deputy Director for Scientific Affairs at OEHA, and I'll be the first presenter. With me today are Carmen Milanes, as well as Linda Mazur and Dr. Rupa Basu of our staff, as well as Guido Franco, who's the technical lead for the Energy Commission's climate change program. Since 2000, OEHA has been the lead for CalEPA's environmental indicators program, and we've been working within the agency as well with the Resources Agency and Department of Public Health in developing a set of environmental indicators that provide important information of the environmental conditions in California. In conjunction with that role, CalEPA asked us to develop a set of indicators specifically devoted to climate change so we can determine the effects of global climate change on California. We have a set of climate change indicators that do show that global climate change is indeed impacting California. These indicators, taken collectively, tell a compelling story and show trends in the way that rising temperatures are affecting our state's environment, ecosystems, and probably our health right now. As your board continues with the implementation of AB 32, we think these indicators will underscore the importance of your efforts to mitigate climate change. The indicators can also help you in your efforts to assess the economic impact of climate change on California and the benefits of effective regulations. Carmen Milanes is the head of our Environmental Indicators Program and will provide you with an overview of our climate change indicators.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Executive Officer Goldstein, board members, we're very grateful to be here today and have this opportunity to share with you information on our climate change indicator work. As you all know, the body of scientific information on climate change and its impact is growing rapidly. Indicators are valuable tools in that they serve to summarize complex information from all these studies to help not only scientists, but also policymakers and the general public to better understand the changes that are occurring and evaluate interrelationships among these changes. We followed the environmental indicator process that we adopted under the EPIC project, collaborated with researchers in various state and federal agencies, universities, and other research institutions, and the outcome of this collaboration will be a report presenting 25 indicators of climate change for California. I should note that research studies carried out under the California Energy Commission's Public Interest Energy Research Program served as one of the major sources we relied upon in identifying potential indicators. Another source that we heavily relied upon is the fourth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, released in 2007. Their report provided us with a framework for identifying and organizing the California indicators. This slide serves to summarize some of the main findings of the IPCC. Very briefly, IPCC determined that the global evidence supported the conclusion that the Earth is warming, that this warming is attributable mostly to human-induced greenhouse gas emissions, and that changes in climate have had observable impacts on physical systems as well as on biological systems. For California, our climate change indicators will present status or trend information characterizing three major topics: drivers of change, changes in climate, and the impacts of these changes. Again, the indicators synthesize the very technical, complex data from in-depth research studies or monitoring efforts into a format that's more easily understood by a broad audience. In the next several slides, I will be highlighting a set of the indicators that will be presented in our report. Let me start with a topic that's very familiar to all of you, the drivers of change. According to the Air Resources Board's greenhouse gas inventory, total emissions of greenhouse gases in California have increased by about 12% since 1990. Carbon dioxide makes up most of these emissions, with the greatest contribution coming from fossil fuel combustion for transportation and electricity generation. Likewise, atmospheric levels of CO2, the most important anthropogenic greenhouse gas, have also been rising. Three California coastal monitoring sites are presented here: La Jolla, Trinidad Head, and Point Arena. And for comparison purposes, also presented are the data from Mauna Loa, Hawaii, the first and longest continuous measurements of atmospheric CO2. The levels of CO2 measured at the California sites appear to track global trends. Pre-industrial levels of CO2 were relatively stable, ranging from about 260 to 280 parts per million. Today, the globally averaged level of CO2 is about 380 parts per million. How is California's climate changing? This graph shows how statewide annual temperatures have deviated from a long-term average from 1948 to 2007. The black line represents average annual temperatures, the red line maximum annual temperatures, and the blue line minimum temperatures. Minimum temperatures, which reflect nighttime temperatures, have increased the most by about 2 degrees Fahrenheit over the past century. A related indicator that's not presented on this slide is one for extreme heat events. That particular indicator shows increasing summertime extreme heat, with the magnitude and duration of nighttime extreme heat increasing more than daytime extreme heat. Rising minimum temperatures can have serious implications for California's agriculture. Fruit trees required an extended period during the winter months, ranging from 200 to 1,500 hours, below a certain temperature threshold to become and remain dormant and eventually bear flowers and fruit. The indicator presented here shows the trend in winter chill in Orland, an agricultural town approximately 100 miles north of Sacramento. There has been a decline in winter chill in this area over the past 50 years. Orland is one of 30 study sites across fruit-growing valleys of California for which winter chill data have been analyzed. All but 8 of these sites show a significant decline in winter chill hours. How have changes in California's climate influenced physical and biological systems in the state? The indicators of impacts that are included in our report are those where an association between the impact and a climate parameter, usually temperature, has been established. This was recently in the news in Sacramento. Glaciers are one of the most visible indicators of climate change.
photographic records of Lyell Glacier in 1903 and more recently in 2004 show a dramatic decrease in the surface area of the glacier. The surface area of seven glaciers in the Sierra Nevada today range from about 20 to 70% of what they were of their size at the beginning of the century. Loss of glacier size occurred during extended periods of above average spring and summer temperatures. Warmer temperatures are also influencing spring snowmelt runoff patterns. Since 1906, the percentage of annual runoff of to the Sacramento River during the months April to July has decreased by about 10%. During warmer winters, precipitation falls as rain instead of snow, and with warmer springtime temperatures, snowmelt occurs earlier in the year. These changes could have consequences relating to flood risk, water availability, and alterations to cold water habitats for salmonid fishes. Finally, another physical impact of warming are the rising sea surface temperatures. This particular one charts sea surface temperatures at La Jolla that have been rising. Warmer ocean temperatures can contribute to the rise in sea level. Changes in ocean temperatures can affect important processes such as upwelling, which in turn can affect chemical and biological processes in the ocean. Ultimately, these changes can impact species distribution, growth, and survival. This is one of four ocean indicators that will be included in our report. In terms of impacts on vegetation, annual tree mortality in the Sierra Nevada in old growth coniferous forests have been increasing at the rate of about 3% per year, and this rate was found to correlate with a temperature-driven increase in water deficit, which is a measure of drought. The increased mortality rate predominantly affected small trees that cannot survive without prolonged water and the slow release of snowmelt late into the spring. The investigators note that even small changes in mortality rate can have profound effects on a forest, and this indicator can provide an early warning of acute changes, such as sudden forest dieback. Another forest indicator is the frequency of large wildfires, those involving over 1,000 acres. These wildfires have been becoming more frequent since the mid-1980s. Earlier snowmelt due to warmer springtime temperatures along with warmer summer temperatures are factors that are found to have influenced this trend. This particular slide shows species responses to warmer temperatures. Species are adapted to specific ranges of climatological and environmental conditions. Range shifts among certain plants and animal species are occurring in the Sierra Nevada. The map on the left shows over the past 60 years, the lower edge of conifer-dominated forests have been retreating upslope with the freeze line. Areas that were historically occupied by ponderosa pine are now occupied by oak and chaparral vegetation, and this change may have consequences for species that inhabit the region and also potentially increase the fire risk of the region since broadleaf vegetation dry out more quickly. The slide on the right shows that some small mammals are now found at elevational ranges different from their historic ranges. The graph partially summarizes results of a resurvey conducted from 2003 to 2006 at study sites in Yosemite National Park that were originally surveyed by a team of scientists from 1911 to 1920, known as the Grinnell Survey, after its lead scientist. About half of the number of small mammal species surveyed showed a change in elevation, either an expansion or a contraction. Most of the responses were upward migration by about 500 meters. Finally, changing conditions can also elicit changes in phenology or the timing of seasonal life cycle events. For butterflies that are dormant during winter, springtime temperatures provide cues for hatching, resumption of feeding, or emergence from pupa, and temperature also plays a role in butterfly migration from overwintering areas. This graph shows that butterflies in the Central Valley are appearing earlier in the spring, and these dates were found to be correlated with hotter, drier conditions. Trend data reflecting the human health impacts of climate change were not readily available for this report. While it is generally known that exposure to extreme heat can cause illness and death, the effects of non-extreme heat are less understood. Analysis of California data conducted by OEHA found an association between ambient temperature and mortality and identified subgroups vulnerable to high ambient temperatures. We believe it's important for heat-related mortality and morbidity to be monitored over time, and trend data in heat-related mortality and morbidity will help inform decisions regarding prevention strategies. In summary, the indicators that I've highlighted for you this morning paint a partial picture of climate change in California. The increased emissions of greenhouse gases, along with increasing atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide, underscores the need for emission reduction strategies, such as those that you're currently working on under AB 32. The indicators show that temperatures in the state are warming, and that the warming temperatures have affected glaciers, spring snowmelt, and ocean temperatures. Finally, several indicators illustrate how vegetation and wildlife are being affected by changes in climate. These include shifts in elevational ranges, earlier timing of life cycle events, and increasing threats to forests from drought and wildfires. Recalling the findings of the IPCC in one of my early slides, it is noteworthy that the indicators, the California indicators, are generally consistent with the trends and patterns that have been observed globally. We hope to complete an internal review draft of our indicator report within the next few weeks, solicit comment and feedback from various investigators that provided us with data, agency, ARB staff, the Energy Commission, and shortly thereafter release a public review draft. In terms of future efforts, pending funding, we hope to develop indicators that would address the implications of climate change on environmental justice, and farther down the line, go back and update our indicators and identify new indicators. As you probably already know, indicators are valuable tools for tracking and changes in environmental conditions, communicating this information to a broad audience, and in the long term, gauging the impacts of the state's mitigation and adaptation measures. We hope the indicators will be helpful to decision makers in evaluating the costs and benefits of regulatory action. And finally, it is our hope that the indicators will provide you and others with additional compelling evidence justifying the need and the urgency to undertake measures now to address the already discernible, measurable impacts of climate change. Thank you for your attention.
excuse me, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I am a big fan of indicators work, as you probably know from my past work at the Resources Agency, and I think these are a good set of indicators, and they're helpful at least in giving a little more clarity to what the problem is that we're facing. I think there are additional indicators that would be appropriate, especially in the biological diversity area. And I know there's work going on in academic institutions around the state to help quantify some of the changes that are going on to genetic diversity, for example, in species in various areas. And I think there are probably other indicators in the water area that could be appropriate, and I'm sure others might have ideas as well. I think the social and economic indicators are obviously the most politically compelling, but maybe harder to isolate from other factors that are causing stresses in the communities that we're looking at, which doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but it's just I think sometimes those get into more difficult areas in terms of deciding what the policy response needs to be. And I think a lot of the value of the indicators is just to paint a picture of really what's going on so that people can make the right kinds of judgments based on it. But I'm pleased to see that this work is being carried on at OEHA and appreciate the fact that you've undertaken this mission. Any other comments, questions? Okay. If not, we'll look forward to hearing from you again. And we have one more item.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Last year, the board approved an aggressive strategy for the state implementation plan. The strategy is all about cleaning up the state's legacy diesel fleet. The two biggest parts are the construction fleet rule adopted by the board in July 2007 and the private truck rule that we're bringing to the board in December. As you'll hear, emission reductions from the 2007 state strategy, including the truck rule, is key to bringing the Sacramento region into attainment. We'll provide a full briefing when we bring the local plan and ultimately the implementing regulatory proposals to you. Today, Laura Lawrence, ARB's planning liaison to the Sacramento non-attainment area, will provide you with an update on the Sacramento SIP as it's being developed. Laura?
Thank you, Mr. Goldstein. Good afternoon, Chairman Nichols, members of the board. Today, we'll be updating you on the status of the federal ozone plan for the Sacramento area. When we brought you the state implementation plans for South Coast and the San Joaquin Valley in 2007, we were able to show that the 2007 state strategy delivered sufficient reductions to provide for attainment of the 1997 8-hour ozone standard in both San Joaquin and South Coast. Is that better?
Better, thank you.
At that time, we had not yet completed modeling for Sacramento, nor had we quantified the benefits for the state strategies for that area. Now that this work is complete, we can show you that, as anticipated, reductions from the state strategy, including the proposed truck rule you will consider later this year, are sufficient to demonstrate that the Sacramento region will attain the 1997 federal 8-hour ozone standard by its 2018 deadline. The local plan, which includes emission control strategies proposed by local air districts, was released in mid-September. Reductions from measures in ARB's already adopted 2007 state strategy and local district measures deliver key reductions necessary to bring this area into attainment. The federal non-attainment area includes all of Sacramento and Yolo counties and portions of El Dorado, Placer, Solano, and Sutter counties, and is governed by five different air district boards. Each air district's board must act on the plan independently. Staff from the five districts have been working together to coordinate development and review of the plan. A draft of the local plan is currently out for public review, with the public comment period ending tomorrow. District staff held a series of public workshops in conjunction with the plan release. Staff at the five districts that comprise the non-attainment area will take their plan to their respective boards in January and February of this year. I'm sorry, of next year. Following local action, we will bring to you for consideration the local plan element and the state SIP commitment. This slide illustrates the progress the area has made in controlling ozone. The figure on the left shows the number of days over the standard, averaged for the years 1997 through 1999, and the figure on the right averaged over 2003 to 2005. Areas in green attain the standard. Areas in yellow exceed the standard on average 10 or fewer times per year. And orange areas exceed the standard more than 10 times, but fewer than 20 times per year. The area in red indicates areas with more than 20 exceedances per year. You can see from these figures that over the six-year period, the green area has expanded, and the red portion of the map has disappeared entirely. This means that more of the region meets the standard, and the remaining area that still violates the standard does so less often. The region has made substantial progress in lowering ambient ozone concentrations, but there remains work yet to be done. In order to attain federal standards, peak ozone values in the region need to be reduced by about 17%. The results of modeling done to support the 1994 federal ozone plan identified the area around the small foothill community of Pool in El Dorado County as the high site for the region. Subsequent installation of a monitor in that community corroborated these results. Since then, the highest 8-hour ozone values tend to be recorded either at the monitor in Cool or at the monitor in Folsom, a city in the eastern edge of Sacramento County. The results of the Central California Ozone Study show that NOx reductions provide significantly more ozone benefits than comparable reductions in ROG. Consequently, while the attainment plan includes both NOx and ROG reductions, it relies more heavily on a NOx reduction strategy. More emissions reductions are needed for the whole region to attain the standard, and this slide shows what is needed. As I mentioned before, the Central California Ozone Study showed that NOx reductions are more helpful in achieving attainment in Sacramento than our ROG. So in the interest of brevity, I'm going to highlight for you here only the emission trends for NOx. This chart shows the current NOx inventory and the forecasted inventory for 2018. You can see from the bar on the left that Sacramento's emissions profile is dominated by mobile source emissions. In particular, as an important goods movement corridor, nearly one-third of their emissions come from heavy and medium-duty trucks, shown on the chart in blue. The next largest category, shown in pale yellow, is off-road equipment, particularly construction equipment, which is targeted by the construction rule adopted as part of the 2007 state strategy in July 2007. Following is passenger vehicles in purple, which includes cars, light-duty trucks, motorcycles, and school and urban buses. In green is boats, trains, and planes. The salmon-colored band represents emissions from industrial sources, including commercial boilers and municipal utilities. These sources are under district jurisdiction. Other emissions, shown as a small aqua band at the bottom of the bar, include other district sources like managed burning and residential fuel combustion. The change between today's emissions and emissions in 2018 in this slide is mostly the result of mobile source controls adopted through 2006 and before applying benefits in the 2007 state strategy. 2018 emissions are nearly 40% lower. And although existing rules will reduce emissions significantly, it is not enough. The red line represents the emissions target needed for attainment. And you can see that Sacramento emissions, without additional measures, would still exceed that value. But the good news is that the 2007 state strategy, together with local measures, will provide the additional reductions needed to bring the region into attainment. You have already adopted several of these measures or portions of these measures. This slide shows the staff estimate of reductions in Sacramento from the 2007 state strategy. I'd like to point out that the lion's share of the reductions, 9.5 out of 15 tons per day of the NOx reductions, comes from the proposed truck rule, which you will consider this year. These reductions will be crucial for Sacramento's ability to attain the standard. You adopted the off-road equipment rule, which focuses on construction equipment in 2007. This rule provides important reductions for Sacramento. US EPA's 2008 locomotive rule also provides benefits. One important element of these reductions is an improved smog check program. The evaporative emissions and visual smoke test portions are already in place. The other portions of the program require either legislative authority or regulatory action by the Bureau of Automotive Repair. Other programs provide significant NOx and ROG reductions. You've already acted on portions of the new off-road emission standards and consumer products programs, but there are other rules that remain to be brought to you for consideration. In addition to the reductions from state measures, the local plan includes commitments to implement new measures to further reduce emissions from sources under district jurisdiction. Since district's authority is limited to stationary and area sources, which comprise a smaller portion of Sacramento's inventory than mobile sources, total reductions available from district measures are much smaller than reductions from state measures. But local rules ensure that all feasible and cost-effective measures are included in the plan. To conclude, I'd like to highlight what needs to occur prior to your consideration of the plan and the timeline for these actions. As I mentioned before, the local draft plan is currently out for public review and comment. Looking forward, the district expects to release the proposed local plan late this year and present it to their boards for consideration early next year. ARB staff hopes to bring the plan to you for your consideration in March of next year. This concludes the staff presentation.
Thank you. Comments, questions from the board? Okay. Thank you for the update. We appreciate it. And we do have one public comment person who has asked to testify. If there's no further staff input, we'll just call on Duncan McFetridge from the New Fuels Alliance.
Good afternoon. My name is Duncan McFetridge. I'm here today representing the New Fuels Alliance. We're an alliance of advanced biofuels companies and cellulosic companies here in California and across the nation. The purpose for my being here today is to submit a letter, which I believe that all the board members have right now.
Yes, thank you.
By 25 of the top executives of companies that are investing millions and millions of dollars in advanced low-carbon fuels in California and elsewhere. The letter asks the board to take a hard look at where the low-carbon fuel standard rulemaking is headed, particularly with regard to the unprecedented public policy decision to enforce indirect market-mediated effects as part of the regulation. The biofuels plants operated by those signed onto this letter are some of the cleanest and most advanced biofuels companies in the world, plants in the world. The signatories of this letter are leading efforts to research alternative feedstocks and commercialize the ultra-low carbon biofuels that we want and that we need. Some of these plants achieve 40% reductions in life cycle greenhouse gas emissions over gasoline, including, and I want to repeat, direct land use change, with potential for over 90% reduction over the full life cycle. But this letter should cause alarm about the draft proposal first discussed last week. The current trajectory of the LCFS regulation could cripple the development of advanced biofuels companies, most of which are signatories to this letter. To be clear, our coalition fully supports efforts to regulate based on direct effects. If a biofuel company uses feedstocks grown to clear-cut forests, they should pay a heavy price. If a biofuels plant wants to be energy inefficient, they should pay a heavy price. But ARB is proposing to do far more than that. They want biofuels to pay for the indirect market-mediated ripple effects purportedly resonating from the decision to use agricultural goods for fuel. They say that
I appreciate the fact that you've come on this way and that you've written this extensive letter, but this is not an agended item, and you've gotten 2 minutes, and you've used your 2 minutes.
Okay,
so
can I just briefly wrap up in 30 seconds?
Please do.
Okay. Our coalition would like to make the following resolution. We would like to propose the following resolution for this matter, and just briefly, if you will, Madam Chair. We agree with the 30 signatories of our letter and the additional 27 PhDs that submitted a letter in June to the ARB, that we are not close to understanding the indirect effects of the different fuel pathways under the LCFS, including but not limited to indirect land use change, one. Two, we agree with Dr. Michael Wang, the author of the GREET model on which the LCFS is based, who claims that today's biofuels are not causing indirect land use change in other countries. Third, I have four. However, we also agree that indirect, and I'll be done.
I don't believe you. Your credibility is impaired. Okay.
However, we also agree that indirect effects must be studied to better understand the true carbon footprint of the energy choices we make. But to do this, we must do this on all fuels. Last, as such, we would support an LCFS that regulates based on direct impacts, including direct land use change from biofuels and other fuels, while setting out a specific schedule and protocol for better understanding the indirect impacts of all fuel pathways and a process for deliberating the public policy implications of adding indirect effects to the LCFS. I appreciate your time. And thank you very much.
I hope some can help you get your comments back there.
I'll submit the rest of my comments.
Thank you very much. We will read your letter, and I assure you there's a great deal of interest here in getting this right. This is an extremely important rulemaking, and we're very well aware of it.
Chair, may I just ask a quick question of staff? Have you a copy of his letter? Obviously, you need one.
We got it this morning.
Got it this morning. Okay, great.
And a press announcement.
And if you would make sure that all the board members receive a copy of your response so that they are kept apprised of what's going on. That would be helpful.
We will.
Thank you. I guess the letter is actually addressed to me, so. No. I have seen a draft of this that came by email, or I guess it wasn't a draft, it was an email version that came this morning as an open comment, so I hadn't read it all, but I will ask the staff to prepare a draft response, and we'll make sure all the board members are aware of it. Thank you. All right, if there is no further business to come before us, I think we will stand adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.